Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, where all the Fukushima radiation is really good for the sunbathers, so they can soak up some extra rays. And my very special guest is Ole Damigod. and I like the fact that his name's Ole, and he's living in Spain. You know, you can't make this stuff up, ladies and gentlemen. You have a website as well, lightonconspiracies.com. So how about we start this off by you explaining to me and obviously the audience members who haven't heard of you yet a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Okay. My body was born in Denmark many years ago, and I moved to Sweden, grew up in Sweden, and then I started working there as a then I turned a profession into journalism, and I started as a journalist for quite a few years. Meanwhile, while I was doing that, I started becoming almost obsessed about the JFK assassination. This was in the early 1980s, and when I saw the Zapruder film for the very first time, that's the film where one bystander has filmed the whole assassination, where it's so clear to see that the final headshot that killed JFK actually came from the front right and not from where we were told, behind and up on the sixth floor. So at that point, I just felt, my God, something really weird is going on here, because we're being pumped with one version that is an absolute lie. It's very obvious that it's a lie. So that started me on a 30-year quest almost to find the truth. And I read a couple of hundred books of the JFK assassination. And while doing that, I really started becoming more interested in the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, and so on. And then while I was deeply involved in trying to uncover what actually happened, the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was gunned down. It's almost on the day today. It was on the 28th of February, 1986. He was shot down by yet another lone crazy guy. And it just, like during these years, after a while, I started to see that these political assassinations, it was almost like they were carried out by a template that, like, they were using like a bullet point list on how to be able to kill a person in a high political position, and how to get away with it, how to dupe the population into thinking that it was a work of a lone crazy guy, instead of that it was actually a massive force of violence with a political overtake, or not even political, a criminal overtake of a country.
Rather large quantity of crazy people rather than just the one.
There you go. And I wouldn't say crazy people, because the people they've used are most of the time highly skilled assassins who are just very drilled in what they're doing. They have no personal motive at all. They're just there as hired killers and trained assassins. And that's, they do their job. They have absolutely no idea who ordered it, who financed it, why they're doing it. They're just carrying out their job. And this is where all of these operations are highly compartmentalized. It's built up on a need-to-know chain, a need-to-know basis, where you only know your very little part, and you have absolutely no idea about what the other people are doing. And this is it's done that on purpose, so that if somebody would decide to start talking or becoming a whistleblower, they will only know very, very little. And also, while they carry one of these hits out, most of the time it's combined with a drill at the same time, a drill that is doing exactly the same, but then halfway suddenly go live without the people who are part of the drill have absolutely no idea that suddenly they're part of a live action. And this took me, like I say, on a very... quite dark and scary road for many, many years, because once you start digging into these things, I'm sure you're very aware of that, you come into what looks like the work of a lone crazy guy. Suddenly you come up higher and higher up in the power pyramids and into the dark corridors of power, which are not the ones that you see normally on TV and so on. It's behind the scenes. And the people behind the scenes, the hidden hand, have a very violent way of dealing with problems. And when you dig too deep for the truth, you become a problem. So, and this is why I'm in Spain. It's 14 years today. And I left Sweden because I had two friends who died, they were murdered. And I got very scared there. So I left Spain I left Sweden to come here to Spain, and here I finished my book. It's called Coup d'État in Slow Motion, about the killing of the Swedish Prime Minister, but also with all the different connections globally, because there's so. This is the thing that I believe that I've been given the gift to be able to uncover this, how they are connected, because it's not only the same power elite that has been behind, I would say more or less all of these terror acts from the 50s and up to until today, but they even many, many times have used the same team of assassins, and I've been able to identify them all, at least most of them, and how they are connected, who did what in where and so on. So depending on what you're interested in, I can go into great details about any of these assassinations, who did what, and how they're connected with the other events and so on.
Okay. Well, I have one statement and one joke for you. Now, you moved to Sweden. You weren't born there. Did you become a Swedish citizen?
Nope.
No? Okay.
Nope.
So you're not technically an artificial Swedener?
Nope.
And also the other part, one person asked me, why don't any of these evil people get assassinated? And I said, it's simple. It's very simple. Only good people would want to see the bad people actually get assassinated, and good people aren't assassins.
Well, there you go. I mean, I wouldn't assassinate anyone. I mean, it's not in my genes, but they have a very, like I say, a very violent way of dealing with problems. And one of the problems is, one of the ways to do that is accidents, sudden cancer, suicides where you stab yourself 15 times, shooting yourself from behind with a shotgun, or drown yourself in your bathtub while being fully dressed, these type of suicides. And no, it's a scary road to go down, and I feel maybe like yourself, that it's like treading in a minefield. You're walking in a minefield, but you do not know when you step on a mine that you find out once it's too late. So
do you know what are the parameters? I mean, you've had a look at the methodology by which they assassinate people. Have you looked at a methodology for how they select the targets? What is a no-no that will get you blown away?
I would say most of the time, the people they choose to take out, many of them are taken out very discreetly, you know, suicides, heart attacks, cancer and so on. But then from time to time, they need to statue an example and to scare people back in line and scare people to shut up. And that's why they commit things like the JFK assassination so openly, right in front of all these cameras, right in front of the whole world seeing. That was a statement, a power statement, saying that we can get anyone at any time, so you better back up and shut up. And this is also why I would say you can often see that after these conspiracies, the big ones, there's like a second conspiracy, but of silence afterwards, where the whole government or whatever in that country will just follow the general official guideline, which is, it was the Patsy, it was the Patsy, it was the Patsy. No critical questions, no nothing, just silence, silence, silence. Because people in so-called power, then they're very rarely aware of the details, who carried it out, who killed this person and so on. They don't know that, but they know the power behind it, and they know that they could be next in line if they don't behave.
So why do you think, I mean, just your personal opinion, that JFK got put on that list for assassination? What did he do to make them do it to him?
There were several reasons. It's like very rarely is there only one reason they take one out. Like you asked, who do they take out? Either it's a real enemy of theirs, so a real opponent, or it's someone in their own lines that they who have become too big-headed or who have become too scared and are sort of at the risk of starting to blow the whistle or talk too much or whatever. But sorry, could you repeat the question? With JFK, the reason why he was taken out, there was, like I say, several reasons, because the power that was behind this assassination was a combination. It was not the CIA, the KGB, or the Secret Service or so on, or Jackie. I mean, there are all these weird conspiracies theories going on. But it was a combination, an unholy liaison between the CIA, the mob, the Secret Service, the Dallas Police, the oil tycoons, the military-industrial complex, and the government. Rogue parts of these groups were together in this unholy alliance. And one of the things that they did was to everyone, just like when they killed Julius Caesar, everybody had to dip their hands in blood so that nobody could point accusingly at someone else. So all had to supply shooters and be part of this assassination. And this is why, if you want to, later we can go into great detail and I will identify the different shooters and who, where they came from and who they were representing and so on. But with JFK, the reason why he was taken out were, like I said, several. One of them were that he decided to withdraw from Vietnam. I think it came to a point during what was called the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was a Russian ship on its way towards Cuba, where Castro had taken over. And on the ship, they had the satellites had identified missiles. And so JFK and his government warned Russia and Khrushchev, saying that if you pass this latitude, we will start a nuclear war with you. And by mistake, this ship actually crossed this line. So JFK was in a position where he was almost sitting with a button, with a finger on the button, and the whole military leadership around him was saying, like, push it, push it, push it, because their agenda, the whole military-industrial complex, their agenda is death and destruction. They do not want peace or harmony, all of these. It's death, destruction, drugs, and multi-billion incomes from all over. So they were pushing him to do this, but he sat there. There were people there who said that he sat with tears in his eyes and he said, I just refuse to be the one who does this to the world. And from that point, he suddenly changed. It was almost like an enlightenment or a, I would say, like a change of person.
A Kundalini awakening.
Exactly, like a change of personality. Suddenly, he became from a good president, but very flamboyant and, very much into women and glitter, glamour, all of this thing. He suddenly became this very, very strong individual who said, we have to stop this madness and I am in a position where I can do it. So at that point, after that, he suddenly took a totally new direction where he said, I'm going to crush the CIA into 1,000 pieces. And he kicked out people like Alan Dulles, which it was absolutely unheard of. Alan Dulles was so crucial in the whole creation of Operation Gladio in Europe, in Operation Paperclip, where they exported all these Nazis from Germany into the States and other countries, the building up of OSS, which later turned into the CIA, and so on. Also, Bissell, General Bissell, and General Charles Cavell. These three he kicked out from the CIA. Absolutely, they were holy cows, untouchables. He kicked them out. He said, we're going to withdraw out of Vietnam, which was a war that hadn't even really started on the American part. It was a French war that America went in there to take over because of the drug trading from the Golden Triangle, the old former Indochina. And he said, at that point, the states only had 16,000 advisors there. He said, we're going to withdraw there. We're going to take out 1,000 people. And by the, I think it was by the end of 1965, everyone would be out there. So that just freaked the military industrial complex out, because they were so set to make billions over there and also get the whole drug trafficking going. So that was also, he turned towards the mob that was partly helping him to come into power through his father, and especially to Sam Giancana in Chicago. He suddenly said, thank you so much for helping me get into power. What I will do is I will chase you down one by one and chop your head off. And he put his brother, Robert Kennedy, in charge of doing that. So Robert Kennedy started to, it was like a witch hunt on the mob. And in 1 year, I think it was 700% higher, what do you call it, verdicts or people put away 700% more than the year before. They were just like, the mob was really in a very critical state. Then he, there were other reasons as well, was that Lyndon Johnson, who he had been forced to take as his vice president, Lyndon was a very, very criminal person who had killed at least seven other people on his way to power. And one of the people, or the main person he used, was a man by the name of Malcolm Wallace, who was also present in Dealey Plaza later. One of the people that Malcolm killed was Lyndon Johnson's own sister, who was, she was drinking too much and she was sleeping around and she was talking very much too much. So he had her killed off. And he was facing, just before the JFK assassination, he was facing that this whole thing would go public and that he would face a long time in jail. His whole career would go down. And he knew that if JFK had lived to the next election, he would be out and he would be in jail. So he was deeply involved in this assassination, as were J. Edgar Hoover, who the chief of the FBI, who also knew that if JFK got reelected, J. Edgar Hoover would be out, and he was the creator of the FBI, or the one who made it legendary, and a total corrupt person who he just said, I'm in, I will help to cover the whole thing up, but you have to give me the leadership of the FBI for the rest of my life, which is exactly what happened. There were many more reasons as well. There were also, JFK wanted to get free from the Federal Bank Reserve, which is not a federal governmental bank, but an extremely criminal private bank coalition that is now controlling the American society. And through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, loads of other people, countries globally as well.
Well, I wouldn't call them a banking coalition so much as a banking cartel.
There you go. I'm not really sure if there's such a big difference in the two, but if bank cartel would be more correct. That's true.
Yeah. Cartel just sounds criminal. Coalition sounds like, I don't know, we've got legitimacy for invading a sovereign nation that never attacked anybody.
No, they're super criminal. Super, yeah. Super criminal. So I think these are the main reasons. There are also theories,
so,
but
so
I don't...
May I just try and sum this up? So JFK pissed off the FBI head, the CIA head, his vice president, and the criminals that were operating the mob in the United States. Probably the most dangerous groups of people you could ever try and piss off, wouldn't you say? And
yep.
You know what this reminds me of? The Dark Knight. You know, the second Batman film, if you've seen it, reminds me of the part where Batman and the police take down the remaining mob members in the city, and the mob retaliates by killing the judges, and trying to kill the chief prosecutor, and of course trying to kill Batman. And Alfred, Batman's assistant, said, You always knew that things would have to get worse before they got better. There would have to be casualties. You don't think that you could mess with all these people without consequence, did you?
Sounds very similar.
How do you feel, emotionally speaking, when you discover that kind of information, that the world is not as it seems? How does it actually feel? Is it just fear, trepidation, that kind of thing? Did you go through an emotional process when you were learning this information?
Extremely emotional, because I had absolutely no idea. And especially growing up in a country, like I said, I moved to Sweden when I was a kid. I was raised in a country where I thought, you know, the police are the good guys, you can trust the government, it's a perfect democracy, we are the helpers of the weak and the poor in the country. And then discovering that in Sweden they were actually following the exact same template as they were using in the other assassinations, meaning that they were somehow connected, that just freaked me out. Because one of the things in this template is that the investigation that is put there to investigate the crime are actually part of the assassination itself. They are just there as a wall of stop, do not enter, and they went that away, that away, that away. That's their whole job, and then stop people like myself. Meaning that I was waking up into the fact that I was living in a corrupt society where the police were actually taking part of killing people that were looking to uncover what had happened to the country's leader. It was highly emotional, I would say, because, and this is, it's been very emotional over the years, because it's just like mind-blowing to see that the world is so different to what I was raised up and grew up to believe.
Ironically enough, when you discover the truth of how the world is being run and you see the insanity of it, all the normal people who don't have any idea how the way the world is really run see you as the crazy one, don't they?
Join the club. It's, yeah, that's the thing. For many years, you know, this is, it's almost like there are different stages, I think, when people wake up. I mean, I woke up so many years ago, so I can see it maybe on I get a more of an overview. The first one is that you deny, you cannot believe what people tell you, that this could actually happen, because it's so unreal, so mind-blowing. But once you start getting to see that, my God, it's actually true, this is actually going on, then you become almost obsessed, I would say. This is a standard phase for most people. So they dig into this wholeheartedly, and they try it, and they, but what they do is they go into all of these dark areas, and they're not grounded in themselves, which means that they go into like a downward spiral, and people around them cannot bear to hear. It's like, shut up, I don't want to hear anything more about all of these awful things. But you become, they're so obsessed, I was as well. And so people label you as crazy, they put a tinfoil hat on your head and dismiss you. So after that, at least for myself, I came to a point where, okay, I'm just going to shut up. I'm not going to tell people. I'm going to continue, but I'm not going to talk about it, because the thing is, people don't want to wake up. They want to wake up in their own time and own space, and you can't force people to do it. You just get the opposite reaction.
Yeah.
So, and it's painful to wake up. So I would very much suggest that don't try and force people to wake up. Live by example instead. Show that you can find out these things, that you can still stand up in truth and without going into the feelings of hate or revenge, or this is at least my way, not pro-violence, not pro-revenge, not pro-hate, but to be able to continue to expose this, but with the intention to lift it, you know. It's like, I don't hate these people, I just want it to stop, you know. I just want them to be the whole thing revealed, so that they can't get away with it anymore. So it will stop, because this world is meant to be a beautiful place. It, the whole nature, everything is designed for absolute harmony and beauty and unity. And then there's this like small group of extreme bullies that are terrorizing the neighborhood, and we're letting them get away with it. They're like a couple of thousand, and we're 7 billion. It's an absolute joke that we are in the state that we are.
Now, what occurs to me there is that the emotional hit when you learn about the conspiracy world and the New World Order and so forth is double-fold, right? It's twofold, because number one, your entire perception of reality has to change, and that in itself is emotional baggage. And as you say, you become obsessed, and then emotional hit number two comes into play. All the people that you think are your friends that would listen to you and so on and so forth, oomph. It's like an emotional ostracization as well as an emotional crippling at the exact same time. In so doing, it occurs to me that there are people like us, not exactly like us, who have woken up to this truth, but instead of learning how to cope with it, learning how to stay reasonable, stay grounded, it damages them permanently, and they lose the ability to socially interact with others. I think it was something I watched. It's funny you should mention the Martin Luther King assassination, because I watched his full 18-minute reflecting pool speech, you know, the I Have a Dream speech today. And one of the things that he was saying, and something you reminded me of, was in our thirst for freedom, let's not drink from the cup of bitterness and revenge. Mm-hmm. And it's quite profound, because I've also, just today, for example, watched two speeches from the 60s, the other being from Mario Silos or something. His name's Mario, and it's the machine speech about how sometimes the machine and its workings become so odious and make you so sick at heart that you can't even participate in it anymore. You can't even passively participate, and that you have to throw your bodies on the gears and on the levers and on the wheels, and you have to make it stop. And I'm thinking that those kind of speeches that were done so many decades ago are so profoundly, shall we say, relevant to today's world. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, before every interview I give, I'm not a religious person, but I really pray that my words will spread peace and harmony and help to lift the world instead of spreading fear and all of these dark feelings. If that would be the case, I would shut up. But I've noticed that during this year and a half that I've been giving all these interviews, that that the response, thank God, have been extremely positive. That people get back to me saying that, my God, now I start to believe in humanity again. I've given up the thought of revenge. Now I focus on helping my surroundings and so on. That if that was not the case, like I say, I would shut up. Because the main thing to do is to raise this whole thing, to lift it out of the grip of this school bully. But it takes courage. It really takes courage, because you need to stand up in truth and courage and balance and say, enough. We have had enough. We don't want you any evil or anything bad. We just want you to stop it. Just like the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa and so on, where they took and put together the victims and the torturers and so on, and gave the guilty parts amnesty in the long run, as long as they totally went clear, total transparency on what had actually happened, so that the body slowly could heal from all of these awful things that had happened. You know, because this is the thing, I feel it's almost we got like this beautiful body, and it's beautiful, but there is a cancer growth. And if we do not expose it, if we don't open up, even though it's painful and smelly, if we do not open and expose the cancer growth, the body will die. But if we do that, the body has this amazing ability to heal itself and so on. So I'm only doing this with the intention of healing. I'm digging myself into all of these very, very dark areas and awful, awful things and terror acts and killings and all of this, but with the intention of healing and lifting. So this is my quest.
Are you familiar with the concept of the wounded healer?
It's nope.
It's a shamanistic thing, whereby you're actually a hell of a lot more capable of helping other people through with their pain, their trauma, if you've been through it yourself and not entirely gotten over it yourself either.
I think that's really interesting, and I think many of us who are standing up in these times are wounded healers. I mean, we've been bashed around and kicked around and you name it, lost friends and had to go through traumas like changing countries, all of these things. I mean, many of the true speakers nowadays have been going through hell, absolute hell. But it's only through that those experiences, at least on my own part, that has made it possible for me to go into, pass through these dark stages and then come out on the other side where love is the answer. And just like you say, I think also if people are very depressed at the moment and they don't know what can I do? Because it looks so overwhelming when you dig into these things. It looks like the game over a long time ago and we just, the only thing option is to lie down and die. I would say it's the absolute opposite, that when you focus too much on your own problems, I, me, mine, that is more or less what is called depression. That gets you into a downward spiral where you just, oh my God, and you're going down, down, down. Mm. The way out is to reach out and help someone, anyone. The more you go away from your own problems and focus on somebody else's, like a wounded healer, but helping other people, that starts raising the energy. It raises your energy, it raises their energy, you feel better, they feel better, people who see this act of kindness feel better, and you start raising the thing. Mm. And this thing with energies, it's not like a new age, hocus pocus. The elite are extremely aware of this, and this is why they're trying to push us down all the time through media and TV. All of this fear, 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 violence that is being pumped on us is to push us down so that our energy is on a level that they can control more easily. So the higher, the more you raise your energy by feeling gratitude and compassion and all these feelings, the more you raise yourself, the harder it is for them to reach you.
So, I think you and I are on the exact same level there. In fact, I remember this one time, one of my guests cancelled out on my show at the last minute. Right? And I was really, really pissed off about it, because he's quite rude about it too. I won't mention who it is. And instead of just sitting there stewing and getting angrier and angrier, although I wanted to, I organized to help 10 people because one person screwed me over. And I felt a hell of a lot better. I was like, oh my God, I'm the better man. Ha 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 ha.
I think you turned a difficult situation into something absolutely beautiful. So I salute you for that one.
Yeah.
But this is the way to do it. We can all do it. It's a template of how to, you can, but because by, there's so many people who have lost hope today. There's so many people that feel so pushed down and it's done by design as well. These difficult financial times have not just occurred. They were part of a design, very deliberate design, to push us down again and again. The thing is that they want to keep us on the lowest possible level, financially as well. Not so that we start starving, because if you go hungry, you have a revolution on your hand. So they don't want you to get on that state to get hungry, but totally helpless. That is the point. So with mortgages and debts and all of these banks chasing you, and that's where they want you. And by the way, do you know the meaning of mortgage?
Death grip.
Mortgage means mortage, and it's a French word, and it means death exactly. So that is really, that is one to stay away from.
Yeah, indeed. So, now, one of the other elements that I think is very important to note is when you first start waking up to this stuff, there's a lot of confusion, mostly about your place in the world. And I had somebody come at me yesterday, and I think you'll like this story. It was kind of like, Vinny, what do I do once I find out all this information? And I go, well, finding out the information exists and accepting it for what it is, that's step one. However, step two is learning how to cope with that information, all right? So it doesn't drive you insane, doesn't turn you into a fetal position every time you think about it, that kind of thing. And I chose to use a bit of humor, a little bit of comedy in order to balance out the equation there amidst all the scumbaggery. And then there's two steps you've got to do after that. First step, figure out how you personally can contribute to making a difference. It's all very well knowing the information, but if you don't know how you fit in the jigsaw and how you can make a difference for humanity, how you can actually make this world a better place, it's not any good, is it? No matter how well you can cope with the information. And then the final step is actually going out and making that difference after you've figured out how you can contribute.
I applaud that.
Mm-hmm. It's not too complicated, and also we always worry and we always beat ourselves up. It's like, oh, am I doing enough? Why won't the people wake up? I feel so stressed out. I've got so much anxiety and depression. It's just like, stop wallowing. Okay, things are about as bad as they're gonna get for you, and now you got to figure out a way to do something about it. Otherwise, you can just, I don't know. Like the elites say, they say they want a great culling and whatnot. My advice to the elite is, if you want so many people to die and what have you, volunteer. You know, nobody's stopping you. Go for your life, son.
Do you know there's a beautiful video on YouTube? It's called The Tiny Dot. Have you seen that one?
No.
It's really, really good. It's like a cartoon, but it's really describing the whole position about the amount of people, you know, they've got round dots there, this amazing, incredible area of rounded dots like this. And then there's this tiny little elite that are trying to control us. And when you look at it on the screen, you can't even see the tiny little dot. I mean, how small it is. That are controlling us, that we are letting control us. It's quite a funny description, and it shows very, it gives a very good overview of how ridiculous this whole thing is.
Also, very similar to the picture that came out of New Zealand of a group of sheep standing together with a farmer and a sheepdog standing next to them, and one sheep standing apart from the herd, and he goes, "Guys, I'm telling you. The dog and the farmer are working together." And the other sheep go, Trevor, you and that conspiracy nonsense.
Once again, a perfect picture, perfect image. But the whole thing is, what is crazy about this whole thing is that we're doing it to ourselves. This is the thing that just is mind-blowing when you think of it. We are doing it to ourselves. We are controlling ourselves. We, the people who manufacture, you know, surveillance cameras or drive the trucks to FEMA camps or are in uniforms controlling the population or our police officers thinking that we're doing, that they're doing, you know, taking care of the population and working for freedom and so on. Absolute bollocks.
Yeah.
They have to really start educating themselves to see whose agenda they're working for. The same with soldiers. It's so tragic when you see it. People signing up thinking that we're going to other countries to liberate them. Absolute, once again, bollocks. You are being used, you in uniform, as brutal enforcers going in there, killing and slaughtering innocent people, children, women, innocent people, for the greed of people you don't even know, bankers, and these Illuminati Freemasonry people, that you are there bloody sword killing and just opening up for drug trading and weapon smuggling and pedophile gangs and so on, at the same time as you're being pumped with that you are doing something good, because they call it Operation Freedom or Operation Stardust or whatever. It is absolutely not true. So I would say, people in uniform and the rest of us, it is time to wake up. Mm. It is time to educate yourself and find out what's going on, whose agenda. Same with parents. Do not pump your children with these awful vaccines. Educate yourself. Find out what is in these vaccines. Why have they put these awful, awful things into these vaccines? And who are manufacturing them? Who are the ones pushing them on you?
Yeah. It's like Deep Throat said, follow the money.
It's the same story again and again. It is this, you know, follow the money. Que bono. Who benefits? Yeah. And you will, when you follow it, I've spent 30 years looking into so many different assassinations, so-called terror acts, I don't even think there is such a thing as a real terrorist anymore.
No, I don't think so either.
Every single time.
May I correct you on that? There is such a thing as terrorism, okay? Yep. You look in the dictionary, fascism, communism, they're systems of government, right? So is terrorism. You look in the dictionary. Terrorism's a system of government by which the government threatens and uses fear and intimidation and terrorizes the population in order to get them to do what it wants. So, terrorism and terrorists do exist. And they're actually all over the place. The problem is, they're not wearing turbans. They don't have big beards. They're not blowing themselves up as suicide bombers. They're wearing hats with Masonic checkers around them. They have badges, suits, and they have big meetings and stuff like that in public. You see them on the TV all the time. You don't realize that these are the terrorists.
I stand corrected. This is exactly the way it is. This is the way it is. And that's why it's so important to uncover groups like the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and so on, to see who are part of these spider webs and where is their loyalty, actual loyalty, not they say that we're elected by the people. Well, bollock, you're just raping us, you're just screwing us over. You know, where's the loyalty? And then once you start seeing that these members, and there are many other groups as well, but these are quite high up in the hierarchy, in the power pyramid, that you will see that, my God, this person, whoever it is, if it's the prime minister or the royal family or whoever, you cannot trust this person.
Yeah.
If they're involved with this, it's an absolute no-no. Do not listen. Do not let this person control your life.
Yeah. That's why my two basic assumptions are, if it comes from officialdom, whatever they're telling you, it's probably the opposite. And if you can't make it in your own kitchen, then it's probably a soft kill by a weapon.
Yep.
I might be wrong, but so far my assumption's been correct, you know, pretty much 99.99% of the time.
No, but I tell you, Vinny, it's wonderful in one way, because if you follow the steps by what they lead us trying to push onto it when it comes to drugs and food and whatever, I mean, that attacking from all over the place, it's very obvious. You just need to do the exact opposite. They say, take this pill, I go for the vitamins. Do not take vitamins. Well, I do take vitamins. Do not use colloidal silver. Use colloidal silver. They're making it very obvious. Use GMOs. Do not use GMOs. Do you know, they're making it quite easy. Just like you say, if it comes from official grounds, do not listen to it or do the opposite.
Yeah.
Stand up, be a free man, make your own choices, and that's the way to go.
Yeah. And you know what's real funny is that you get branded as just anti-authority. Well, I don't know about you, but I draw authority from three sources. Number one, my parents, because they're responsible. They brought me into this world. Number two, myself, because I'm in charge of myself. And three, I don't leave that to government or anything. I leave that to the man upstairs. Whatever higher spiritual force or God or anything like that is up there, there's something. I'm pretty convinced of it. And if there is a good force in this world, and surely there's an evil force and what have you, I'd say I'd probably rather regard the good as an authority rather than the evil scumbaggery, which I can actually prove has no basis, or rather rational basis, for their presumed authority.
I can only agree once again. But at the same time, it's also important, I think, to not just blame the dark forces, but also see that in this reality we're living in, there's a duality there. You need left to see right. You need up to understand down. You need to sad to be able to understand happy.
You need the dark in order to see the light.
You need dark to see the light. That's the whole thing. And in this universe, there is this struggle between the light and the dark. It's been for if you look, all the old stories, you know, with a knight going up against a dragon, you know, it's been the same story for centuries and generations and thousands of years back. It's the same story. Now we're in a high-tech version of it, but it's a more, I would say this is an amazing, very challenging, but amazing time to be alive, because this is the time, I believe, that we're very, very close to take the step to the next level. And in my opinion, we're coming into an absolute beautiful time, I think, because I don't know if you have seen these experiments where they have like a loudspeaker they put on the floor, and then they put a piece of cardboard on top of it, then they put sand on top of it. When they put a low frequency in the loudspeaker, the cardboard starts shaking, and the sand just rearrange itself into like a beautiful, beautiful pattern, almost like a snowflake pattern. Then when you raise the energy, when you raise the frequency, then the pattern stays the same. And then after a while, it starts shaking. And suddenly, it doesn't go gradually, it just goes, and it just chops into a new, beautiful, very different, but absolutely beautiful new pattern, like a snowflake again. You raise the frequency, it goes again, it doesn't move, then it starts shaking, and boom, it goes, it's like locks into a new beautiful pattern again. Don't ask me how it's done or whatever, but this is the way what happens when frequency goes up. And I think that we are in the evolution of the human race, we are in one of these where the energy is going up. They say that it started in the 1980s there sometimes, and now we are at a point where everything is shaking, everything looks, it doesn't look everybody go it's too much. That's when it's shaking. If we can just continue to raise the energy very shortly, I think our lives, everything will just lock into a new way of life that we have not seen before. It would look more or less the same, but the feeling will be totally different. And the feeling, I think what is going to happen is that we're going to come to a point where duality suddenly stops to exist. We have evolved into the next level where we stop seeing each other as separate, where we stop seeing each other as competitors or enemies, but that we suddenly start seeing each other as brothers and sisters, as one, together with Mother Earth, that we can just help and support and lift this whole thing. So I think we're at a super, super time. You know, this is not a time to sit and pick your nose and change the other channel. This is a time to wake up and be part of this whole thing, be proud of it, stand in honor, stand in transparency, and be courageous. Mm. This is a good time. Well, you know, the native Indians, they say that this is the time when the souls, the strongest of the strong of our ancestors' souls, had come down to this earth to be part of this whole thing. So we who are alive are the strongest of the strong. We can cope with this. We can cope with this. It's just a matter of do not get buy into their fear games.
Yeah. Well, here's another thing. You don't know what you're capable of coping with until you're forced to cope with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like you don't know how brave you are until you have to really be really brave, you know. And I've got this idea that, I don't know, it's kind of like networking to a degree. I don't know if you've ever done this or seen somebody do this, but I've done this. You walk into a party, you don't know anybody, but within moments, you're complimenting this person, you're complimenting that person, you're showing this person a new thing that they can do, or a new mixer with their drink or something like that. And it's almost like you become like a billiard ball, actually being forced into the situation where you can hit all the other balls and actually put them down into the slots precisely where they need to be. And I think this is actually a good way of analogizing just how effective one person with a little push can actually have profound effects on the lives of others. And we have a profound responsibility, I think, then, inherent in our powers. And one thing that you said before is about how everybody needs to wake up, and you also said that you can't force people to wake up. That's what we need to do, but you can't force them to do it, much like you can't force a horse to water. And so what I was thinking is that something that Dr. Rima Labo from the Dr. Rima Truth Reports told me is that statistically speaking, in order to accept an idea that is alien to you, you need 7 different people to mention the exact same thing for you before it sinks into your brain and you're capable of accepting it. And that actually triggered a profound realization in me, like, oh my God. If I just say one thing to one person, like a little information time grenade bomb or something like that, you just pull the pin, throw the information in there, and you're just like, hopefully, if I throw my grenade in and 6 other people throw their grenade in, it'll blow up in that person's face and wake them out of their slumber. You know, and it's all just about playing your part, because I've seen so many people in this movement take responsibility for waking everybody else up. And as a result of trying to wake everybody else up, they never wake up to the truth themselves.
You can only do the one in the mirror. You know, the man in the mirror, that's the only one you can actually control. So you have to do it yourself. Don't try and do it with everyone else. You wake up and raise your energy and people around you will start changing.
Yeah. I remember my family were actually pretty aggressive and kind of don't listen to me. They still don't listen to me to an extent, but they respect me now because I've made quite the success of myself out of this industry. You know, I've become a pretty prolific talk radio show host. I've interviewed celebrities and stuff from all over the place. I've got a huge network of people out there, thousands of Facebook friends and fans and an income from it and all of that kind of stuff. So they don't openly criticize me about thinking these things anymore because they know that I can't be doing something totally wrong because I'm very sane. I still sound pretty intelligent, don't I? And I'm being successful at what I'm doing. So it lends credibility to everything that I say, to a degree. Even though they still don't entirely believe me, even though they still haven't totally woken up, many of them have asked me questions. Those kind of questions where you kind of get an inkling like, they might be starting to get a little bit of it now. Like my sister once asked me, are chemtrails in any way related to Monsanto? You know, it was just like, I gotcha. All right, well, we're coming to the end of our first hour now. What I'd actually like to do, just before we take that break, is I'd like to play a clip for you, ladies and gentlemen. This is a speech that John F. Kennedy gave about the American frontier. We'll return just after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Don't you go anywhere, folks.
The pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build our new West. They were determined to make the new world strong and free, an example to the world. Some would say that those struggles are all over, that all the horizons have been explored, that all the battles have been won, that there is no longer an American frontier. And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. Beyond that frontier are uncharted areas of science and space, unsolved problems of peace and war, unconquered province of ignorance and prejudice. I'm asking each of you to be pioneers towards that new frontier. My call is to the young in heart, regardless of age. Can we carry through in an age where we will witness not only new breakthroughs in weapons of destruction, but also a race for mastery of the sky and the rain, the ocean and the tides, the far side of space, and the inside of men's minds? All mankind waits upon our decision. A whole world looks to see what we shall do. And we cannot fail that trust, and we cannot fail to try.
Hope you enjoyed that quote from JFK there. And in fact, Ole, you never even heard that one before, have you?
Not that I can remember.
Yeah.
But he had some... the guy who wrote his speeches was absolutely amazing.
Who, do you know who that was? Who
wrote I can't remember. I can't remember, but there was... he's actually a Danish ancestor. I can't remember his name now, but he was super duper at what he was doing.
Mm, no doubt. And this is another thing that actually strikes me is credit where credit's due. People always credit the presidents with having giving these great speeches. They're just teleprompter readers, bro. They're not coming up with this stuff on their own, are they?
Nope. That's one of the secrets with the success of Obama. Not his own words. He's just pumping them up there.
Yeah. I have a picture of that. It's a, you know, the little bobblehead things that you have in your car, you know, as the car moves, the little thing nods and what have you. Well, I have a Baracko bobble, except instead of its head, bobbling up and down, it bobbles from side to side to his teleprompters. And you'll notice whenever Barack H. Obama, or just Barry for short, whenever he's given a speech, he never makes eye contact with the crowd. Like, he's never looking straight in your eyes. You know, he's never looking straight in your eyes. It's always, from the left to the right. There's no eye contact with the crowd because the crowd can't tell him what to say.
No, exactly. And they've always got two prompters, one, just like you say, one to the left, one to the right.
Yeah.
So...
Mm. It's just a manufactured farce, and I think that realness is something that's greatly missing from almost every spectrum of human interaction these days. You know, the mainstream media that I listen to, when they're interviewing somebody kind of like you, they're always cutting them off, and they've only got them on for like 5 or 6 minutes or something like that at tops, and I think that's part of the reason why I do longer form interviews, is because I want to be the very antithesis to that. I think that information cannot be compressed into sound bites and should not be.
These things that we talk about are so complex that you really need time to be able to do it. This is also why I think that there are very few real journalists left today, because they're so stressed for time and... due to their editors, they're so pushed to do, you know, check out what Britney Spears had for breakfast, or what some kind of sports guy, his knee problems or whatever it is, that they don't have the time to really dig into these important things. And that is also done by design, that people are not supposed to have enough time, journalists, to be able to really dig into and find out what is really going on.
I always found it very like sports journalism. Have you ever heard of this? Sports journalism. I was like, isn't that an oxymoron? Like like military intelligence? It was like, so much of life is just a cruel irony, bro.
It is indeed.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, well, you know, at least we can have fun amidst all that stuff. And you know, I've still got that one rule. When I started off the show, I was doing it on American Freedom Radio, and the network imposed on me one rule. Two words: have fun. Because if you're having fun, the audience is having fun. Aren't you having fun, ladies and gentlemen? You know?
We are.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah.
But it's back to this thing about raising the energy as well, and I think humor is super important in this as well. You know, even in the darkest of times, get laughter in there and it will help you. It will boost the energy, it will boost your the whole feeling and so on.
Yeah.
Listen, Vinny, if it's okay, I would like to read some lyrics to the song in 1997. It's still...
Sorry, can you repeat that? There was a bit of a cutout.
Okay. If it's okay with you, I would like to just read the lyrics to a song I wrote in 1997. Which I think is still very much up to date. Would that be okay?
Proceed.
It's called From Prison to Paradise. Sounds very familiar to David Icke's book. Once upon a time...
It sounds like New Zealand.
There you go. Once upon a time, in a place not far from here, there was so much loneliness, despair, and oh, so much fear. Darkness ruled all over the land. There was lightning in the sky, causing wars and separation with no one knowing why. These evil times raised leaders disguised as kind and true, hiding the true in misty fog so only very few people knew. Controlled by an elite few, manipulating you and me, closing out the light and power that can make us all be free. Mm-hmm. And then it's the break. Wake up, wake up, we gotta wake up. Wake up, wake up, we gotta wake up. Mm. Forced by invisible powers, demanded to conform into shapes unknown to mankind, making him totally abnormal. Drowned in debts and sorrows, blaming others for their lot, made man believe to be inferior, feeling tiny like a dot. But then came time of change, covering countries and their towns. Few became many, and soon the prison wall came down. Starting with a man in the mirror, staring right back into their eyes, understanding that this was a chance to stop those hideous lies. Unhappiness is merely an illusion of misery, based on brainwash and a misconception of true reality. From now on, let's build bridges between our souls and hearts, so we together can rejoice when the final change comes to its start. And then it comes again, wake up, we gotta wake up. Turning prison into paradise may seem too much to achieve, but believe me, it only takes one strong spirit to be free. The true power of a pyramid is never ever at the top. Instead, it's we, the people, that can make this global game stop. Did you get it? And then wake up, we gotta wake up. Thank you, Vinny.
I do like the idea of creativity in the face of these people, because something that's occurred to me quite strongly, in fact, is that we're not dealing with normal people who don't think the way that that normal people do. And I think this is why normal people can't comprehend their actions. You know, oh, why would somebody ruthlessly exterminate and enslave the entire human race? You know, I just don't get that. You know, it doesn't make sense to me. Well, it's probably because you're not a ruthless criminal sociopath. Okay? If you were, it would make total sense. You know, be like, oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
No, I totally agree with you. This is one of the things that I'm still struggling with, is to understand the mentality. Like, when you look into what's going on behind the scenes with these people, I mean, it's so dark and black and so-called evil. It's incredible. I don't get it. And I'm not trying to either, because I'm not one of them. I'll never get it. I can just see this is the way they do it. This is the way they work. This is the way they function. And this is also the way that makes it possible for someone like myself to expose it, because they are not aware of what they're saying sometimes, because they take for granted that everybody knows what they know. So sometimes it just pops out, you know, these Freudian slips. They say things like, whoa, 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 what did you just say? And, you know, it's like with the truth, it's very easy. You don't have to control the truth or to remember the truth. The truth is the truth. This happened. But once you get into this conspiracy world, and where people are trying to cover up the real truth, you have this web of lies that just grows bigger and bigger, and people can, they don't know what other people have said that were lies, and it just goes into a total mess, which is perfect once again for someone like me, because then it's so obvious that something very wrong is going on, and then you can start uncovering this web of lies.
It reminds me of what Mark Twain said. He said, if you always tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything you've said.
Hallelujah. Right. Yeah. On.
It's actually quite a lot easier, not a whole lot of stress. There's not a whole lot you have to remember if you just tell the truth. And I think that's actually really quite, in and of itself, that's a self-evident truth. And I think... one of the things that occurred to me, and as we played that JFK quote before, I've got a confession to make. During that JFK quote, when I first heard it, and just like when I was listening to, Martin Luther King's full I Have a Dream speech today from the 60s, I wept for one main reason, that these people were saying such great things, and they could have done such amazing things for humanity, and they got snuffed out. And the inherent tragedy in that was what made me cry.
I can only agree, because the world would not have been the same place had JFK lived, had Martin Luther King, had Robert Kennedy lived. It would have been a totally different place, that is for sure. Let's not forget Malcolm X either. I mean, but there's a major reason why these people have been taken out. And like I say, I've been able to track down the people who did it, and also to also the links. I mean, there's quite a few of the people who were in Dealey Plaza that was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was killed. The same people killed Che Guevara, Salvador Allende, Pablo Neruda, Olof Palme in Sweden, Uwe Barschel in Germany, Robert Smith in South Africa. There are just loads of them. And it's the same team that they've been flying from country to country, just carrying these things out.
And it's not just if you're one of the important people that they'll take you out. They also just take out witnesses. I think I saw Jim Mars being interviewed by Alex Jones about the JFK assassination. And Jim Mars was saying that there were well over 100 witnesses in Dealey Plaza who died within weeks of the assassination or something like that, because they were trying to go to the authorities saying that they saw shooters or something of that nature. They just get taken out, you know. It's kind of like tying up loose ends, I think is the phrase.
It's cleaning up. They call it clean-up squads. And I would say Jim Mars, his figure is not really correct, because it's more close to 300. And it's not only witnesses, it's people that were somehow connected to the whole, people that were even either taking part of it or knew too much, or witnesses. There are loads and loads. And lately I've been tracking down some of the people that have been part of this cleanup squad, or death squad, if you want to call them. And there are especially two that have been extremely active over the years. And I would say these are maybe this is one of the biggest scandals in modern times, because these two people, it's a man by the name of Walter Tobinski and a man by the name of Clyde Forshaw, from Toronto. They have been used by since the late 50s, during the 1960s, all the way up until today, to take out, like I said, they were part of these major conspiracies, the JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy assassinations, but they were also part of the death squads that have been cleaning up after these, and many of the other major terror acts and so on, because we're talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that have been killed. It's the same when you look into these big assassinations. You have the same pattern in Sweden, where witnesses have been terrorized and journalists have been killed, police officers, all of that. Maybe not in the same multitude as in the States, but it's the exact same pattern. And like I say, it's even the same people that have been flown in from abroad to deal with it.
And you never hear about these people.
Never,
that's the other thing. Like, major journalist dies. You don't see a headline. You don't have a news story. You don't have nothing. There's just hundreds of people just disappear. Nobody hears anything at all. It's like they just vanish.
Do you know, they say that I've seen statistics that when they looked into the JFK assassination, and the chances that people would die young at the rate they've done around the JFK assassination is 1 to 10 trillion. I mean, all these suicides, accidents, hangings, killings, you name it. I just wanted to stop, you know, by exposing what's going on. I just wanted to stop because it's going on because you're not aware of it. People are not aware of it. Just like you say, you will never hear this through main media. This is one of the blessings with the internet, that information spreads so quickly and so fast all around the place. So this is the way to go. And I think especially nowadays with the beautiful marriage between cell phones and YouTube, where people can actually film, especially when people in control or uniform and so are getting totally out of order. Once you start filming them, it's like neutralizing them most of the time, and then poof, up on YouTube right away. So that they can't get away with it, so that they will suddenly start being exposed and neutralized in that way. And I think it's a beautiful thing.
Well, I think if you're going to try and get these psychos out of control and out of their dangerous positions, it's kind of like you can't make them act like nice people. Okay, you can't change their mentality to a large degree. You can, however, disarm them. You can, however, expose their tactics so that they can't use them anymore and get away with it. All right, it's about basically taking away the weapons of war that they use. And I think that's part of our job, really, is to de-occult this knowledge of how conspiracy works, how these syndicates operate globally, and who's really kind of running the scenes and pulling the strings and so on and so forth, you know. And me personally, I'm not a heavy researcher. I'm simply an interviewer. So I hear lots of people say a lot of things. However, I'm not totally well-versed in perhaps some of the things that they do, some of the books that they write, and so on and so forth. But I get the general idea. And once you've got a general idea of it, it's very, very difficult to be, shall we say, not cynical. You know, yeah. You ever notice this kind of like rising cynicism amongst us? I remember I came home one day, and my wife tells me, "Vinny, did you hear about this truck bomb that they found in Times Square?" And I go, "Oh, don't worry about it, baby. It's probably the FBI." And it was.
it always is. It always is.
Oh, and I came up with a realization that day. When a bomb gets found and it doesn't go off, it's the FBI. When a bomb does go off, it's the CIA.
The bombs are most of the time supplied by the FBI anyway.
Mm.
It's as far as I've seen, on American soil, every single act of terror since the early 1990s have been supplied by the FBI. I think there's 24 or something like that, and they've all been supplied by the FBI, the bombs and the thing.
Do you think the FBI was actually involved in the implementation of this, or were they being simply used like patsies themselves?
No, the agencies, they're being used. They're totally aware of it. I'm not saying that every single FBI agent is aware of it or is a bad guy.
Absolutely, of course not.
But we're talking about the rogue elements within it, for sure. They are totally in this.
Yeah.
And the CIA, I mean, it's the same. You got like the same a coin with multiple sides. The CIA, the mob, the FBI, the Secret Service. These are just different sides of the same coin and used for different things. You know, so the CIA officially they're not allowed to kill people on American soil. So what they use the mob to do the killings, but the orders come from the CIA. You know, and then the CIA. Looks the other way when the mob does some of the stuff, and the FBI You know, it's just it's the same mechanism. It's the same organism that I just use for different tasks.
In early modern England, when there were, you know, fiefdoms and whatnot, a lord of the land, in order to, you had a rule when collecting firewood. It was called by hook or by crook. All right, which means the only two ways you could get firewood is if there was a dead branch off of a tree that you could hook off, or you could commit a crime and chop down a tree. All right. And that's kind of how these people get away with all their, how they attempt and do all their assassinations and terrorist acts and so on and so forth, isn't it? Whether by hook or by crook, they get it, they get away with it, don't they?
They do. They do. And this is why it's following this template. If you want to, I can go into a bit of a template on how to commit an assassination or
please do
a terror act.
Please do. Which I one? Really want to know how to assassinate people effectively and get away with it.
Okay, because I think this is crucial, because once you see the template, you will start seeing it very obviously. Nowadays it's on a weekly basis now with the, all of these so-called terror acts.
Yeah.
So what do you prefer, a terror act or an assassination? You pick.
Let's go for an assassination first.
Okay. An assassination first. Okay. This is how they do it. Nowadays, it's the last few years, the technology has risen quite a lot. So the surveillance thing might be more high tech than what I'm describing. But this is what it used to be. First, you choose a victim. Like I said before, the victim is more or less always either a direct enemy or one of their own people that they want to get rid of. So either because he's gone too big-headed or unreliable, or they fear that he's going to become a whistleblower or whatever it is. So, or they just want to statue an example and they need to take out someone to make it. So what they do is they fly in a team, a surveillance team that will spend like 3-4 weeks keeping the victim to become under surveillance. These people will normally be like three teams of three people with walkie-talkies, some kind of communication equipment. Nowadays, it's getting smaller and smaller, so you don't notice them so much. But it used to be walkie-talkies. So what this team does is it's tracking the victim, all the habits, where he's going, where he's working, how he's driving to and from work, and so on. And also, at the same time, they check out the good places to make the hit. They check out, like I said, where would be a good place to do the hit itself, and also where there's always multiple escape cars around it, where the escape cars should be. They check out all the, you know, so that no dead ends. If the escape cars have to make a run for it, they check out dead ends, traffic lights. They time, you know, if there's the train crossings or all of these type of things, so that they would be very aware of how to get away. Okay, so the surveillance team will be there for a couple of months, a couple of weeks or a month. And in the meantime, while they're doing that, the people behind it, let's say that I'm part of the power elite, and this is the country I've chosen, and this is the victim. So what I do then is I start preparing a patsy. The patsy is somebody that he needs to work good in media. He needs to look strange or look weird, say weird things, have a violent background or something. Or it's a group that you or somebody you just have a problem with. Like nowadays, some of the mass shootings, for instance, in the States have been blamed on guys whose fathers have been very deeply involved in trying to track down what the global elite have done, how they got away with money laundering and so on. So by blaming one of these mass shootings on the son of one of these guys, they've neutralized the father as well. So they got rid of somebody, two flies in the same hit, if you understand what I'm saying. So they prepare a patsy, and what they do is these patsies, they in the 60s, it used to be the East Germans or the Russians during the Cold War. Then after the Cold War, the boogeyman changed appearance. They had to find a new type for the boogeyman, so they went into the Muslim trend. because Muslims were really, really good for a while there, because they got big moustaches and big brown dark eyebrows. They look threatening, which works really good in media. And they got very strange names like Abdul Mahomla or something like that. Super. Also because they have pumped us through media for such a long time. So that most people, if you say Islam, people right away in their mind connected with the word terrorism. Muslim equals terrorist. That's the thing. Now, after the Muslim thing, that went sort of a bit over the top after 9/11. So now they started changing it around so that the boogeyman can look like anyone. You know, nowadays it could be a truth seeker, a peacemaker, a vegetable gardener, a yogi, whatever. You know, and they do now. They change the trend so that people would think that it can just be anyone. I need even more protection. So they're preparing the patsy. I'm sorry.
And every life.
The reason why they always want one lone crazy guy, and the reason why they want that he's alone is that then there's no conspiracy behind it. There's no planning. There's no reason or political motive or whatever behind the assassination. And the reason why they want him crazy is just the same. He was crazy. He just went up, shot the guy, case closed. He was crazy, no motive, boom. So this is why they always try to blame it on one crazy guy. Mm. So, like I say, I prepare this patsy, and sometimes I involve him so that he has no idea that he's been manipulated, but so that I can get him into the right position and so on when the shots are fired, so that he can be blamed right away. I also prepared evidence that right away would point towards the patsy. As soon as the shots are fired, it was the patsy, it was the patsy. Okay, so I got the surveillance team there. I'm preparing the patsy. I've got evidence that was pointed his way. At the same time, I also get my own investigation on standby. This investigation, it's crucial that I can control the key people in this investigation. So that as soon as the shots are fired, boom, I move in my own investigation. I kick out all normal, honest, decent detectives and police officers and so on to the side, because this investigation, their task is to not find the real truth, but to only point toward the patsy and to stop people that will dig too deep into it. Okay, so in the meantime, while I'm doing this, I'm getting a very clear picture through the surveillance group of where would be a good place to get hit and all of this. And so we're getting close to the hit itself. At that point, I fly in a team of assassins. This is mostly people taken from the Gladio network, Stay Behind network, or just highly skilled killers like former mercenaries, security people, right-wing police officers. We're talking about right-wing people. I fly them in. This group, very often they don't even know each other personally. There are no connections, no obvious connections between them. They work under code name, on false identities. So they don't even know each other. They don't know each other's background. They just know their task. And so I fly them in, and they're helped by local, they got local backup. This is normally, once again, local military people, right-wing police officers, security people, that type of people. Very often, once again, connected to the Stay Behind network. So they take care of this group, and what they do is they drive them from different safe houses. They only stay in the same place for a very short time, so they keep moving them around so that they will have no problems with neighbors seeing strange things and so on. They will also supply them with all the logistics like cars, ammo, weapons, food, maps, all of these things, radio equipment and so on. So by then, now we've got the hit team there. They've been informed where to do the whole thing. The surveillance team have done their thing, so we're getting close to the hit itself. Out go the surveillance team. There's also most of the time, I would, or always, there's a commando center very close to where the hit is done itself. Some kind of communication center where the whole operation can be organized from. I would say once again, these events are more or less always filmed at the same time. And the HIT team itself consists of a plan where there will be more than one option, multiple shooters, often triangular fire, and so on. Because the main thing is that this person cannot get away alive. He must die. That is the only thing that matters. Okay. So everything is put in position. You got the media at the same time. Sometimes the media that I control indirectly start leaking out about the patsy, different stories and so on, so that if this is not just a lone patsy but a group, the media will leak out strange stories about this group, saying, for instance, oh, these true seekers or yogis or whoever it is they've decided to blame it on. It could be Mormons or you name it. They have strange meetings and you know, they read these strange books and they've got all these theories, and I'm sure they have hidden guns under the floors and they're preparing something. All of it leaking out, not very obvious, but so that it's preparing the subconscious of the population, saying, ooh, that's a bit strange. Meaning that once the whole thing is pulled off, right away, it's so much easier to start believing that it was the patsy. Okay, so we're getting close to the hit itself, and the victim comes in. What they do is they try to infiltrate as well the bodyguard. If this person has a bodyguard, that would be pulled away. No police security, nothing like that. Everything is pulled away, just like Julius Caesar when he he was just surrounded by enemies, and his lifeguards, bodyguards were pulled away, and boom, the hit is done. So the person is killed, and then what happens is that instead of, if this had been a normal thing, if you, for instance, had crashed a window in a shop center or something like that, within a few minutes or a minute or like that, the place would be filled with police. Here instead, when we're talking about a hit on a top political person or someone else on that level, what happens is that everything is delayed. There's a delay from the alert when it goes out. It's a matter of minutes, but that delay is there to make sure that the people involved, the assassins, that they can get away in time. There's also surrounding the place where this person is being murdered, police cars and people in uniform that are not real policemen. They're just there dressed up, and their task, or it's the local police officers that are involved in the whole hit, but their task is to stop normal people from following and trying to interfere in the hit itself. So they will be surrounded. They can also stop people from chasing them, the assassins, in the getaway cars and so on. So that's their task. Anyway, so it's delayed. The hit team get away, and then boom, the police goes in, and they make like an iron ring around the hit itself, but making absolutely sure that everybody has gone away. And then they start looking really, really intensely in all the wrong places all the time to delay, so that everything is done. In the meantime, I move in my own investigation, and the main task number one is to deal with media. And my investigation will say, oh my God, it's such a, this awful thing has happened. It's awful. But we believe it's the patsy. Okay. So the media is looking that way. In the meantime, I move in a technical team that goes to the murder site. And instead of what you think they're doing, you think that they're collecting evidence from what had happened. That they do not. They do the exact opposite. They clean the site for the real evidence, and instead they place the evidence that will point towards the patsy. And that is the way the assassination is carried out in itself. But then there's one major thing as well that I haven't mentioned, and that is the commissions. Because once this is done, what they're aiming for is a case closed, you know, like quick and easy, just chook. fix it, and very often the patsy is killed or something like that, so he won't even be given a chance to speak out or say anything like that. Just boom, he was shot dead. Oh, we're very sorry all of this has happened, but thank God it's solved. Case closed. Goodbye and thank you. But if people like myself and journalists and the public person goes on and say, but you know, listen, this is not actually what happened. There's all of these witnesses that have been disregarded. There's all of these witnesses that have even been threatened and all of these things. We need to look into it. And if this pressure keeps pushing, saying something needs to be done, you have to look into this. If they cannot get away with it in any other way, they will apply a so-called commission. And this commission will be called something fancy like the Truth Commission, the Freedom Commission, the Act of Freedom, blah, blah, blah Commission.
The 9/11 Commission.
Yeah, all it's the same story again. You know, something that will make you give the public the illusion of that something is actually going to be done. But what they do is this commission, the standard is that they go in and they spend about a year dragging it out. There's loads of articles in the newspaper saying absolutely nothing, because what they're doing is they're looking into the investigation, not the crime. They're looking into the investigation, how that was done. And then after a year, they will come out and say, well, we finally, here is our report, and it's like 1,000 pages thick with saying absolutely nothing. But we've looked into the investigation and we find some, they made some mistakes, but they've done it a good job, and so have we. And that's it, case closed. By then, a major part of the population will be so fed up with the whole case that they don't want to hear anything else. But if some people are still pushing for the real truth to come out, in the end, they will apply a second commission. And the second commission will look into the first commission, what they did. Once again, with a year down the line, sometimes they arrange for local or scandals within the committee that will, so that they have to replace the member.
Yeah.
One of the members that will then delay the whole thing for months again.
It's like, who watches the watchers? Who commissions the commissioners?
And often you can see that it's the same people in these commissions, if it's not the Submarine Commission or the 9/11. Do you know, they just swap places so that one person is the chairman in one and the secretary in the other one and so on, given the illusion of democracy. And like,
Excuse me, sir. Are you a scumbag? Well, yes, I am. And have you been involved in a lot of these different commissions before and botched the complete investigation? Well, yes, I have. Well, we have a job for you.
There you go. And you will also very often see that members of these commissions are in the Freemasonry network, because the Freemasonry network is very, very powerful in these areas. So that's the assassination one. I can do you the terror act.
Yeah,
do you want to go?
Let's roll straight through.
Let's roll straight through, because that's quite similar. Now you're seeing the panel. But the other one, when it comes to a so-called terror act, they base that on an old Roman tactic. I mean, these things have been carried out since I think the Romans perfected these tactics, and it's just been modernized. Okay, this one is called, they call it a three-step rocket. It's called problem, region, solution. Sorry.
That's problem, reaction, solution, or the scientific term is thesis plus antithesis equals synthesis, i.e. you got one problem and then you got the solution coming in, and then they start swimming together. And they always go upstream, and you're the one who winds up getting eaten by the bear during your spawning season.
More or less like that. No, the thing is, like, if you look at Latin America, for instance, when they did all of these military coup d'etats, that was backed and supported by the CIA, but carried out by the same assassins that were part in Dealey Plus and so on. If we take, for instance, in 1973, when they overtook Salvador Allende, murdered him. By the way, it was on 9/11, 1973. They loved these dates. They're very ritual. Anyway, what happened was that they had a small group of military people who overtook the government, killed a whole lot of them, and with a very short notice, boom, they got into a position of power, which was great. One way, if you look at it from that perspective. But what happened was that from that day, the next morning when people woke up and suddenly saw, my God, our country is ruled by crazy military people. From that very moment, you had loads of problems with uprisings, demonstrations. They had to do mass arrests. They even filled like a whole football stadium with thousands and thousands of people that they thought, if we don't arrest them now, we would have problems later on. They started mass executing them. They had to torture them to find out where the rest were hiding. It was a mess, and every one single one they killed, then they had problems with their families because they wouldn't give up trying to find out what happened to their relatives and so on. An absolute mess. So that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to secretly create a problem. Secretly create a problem so that you can get the reaction from the public, from the population of that country, asking for a solution, and then I will come with a solution. So, for instance, in New Zealand, if I'm the one in power in New Zealand, and I want the people, the police to have the same, I'm sorry about my throat, have the same power as...
Would you like to just take a minute to like try and cough all of that out, you know, to get it all out, because... yeah, it seems to me that these patterns keep repeating, and the only reason why they're continually capable of getting away with terrorism and assassinations and problem reaction solution is because the methodology is not known by the general public, and it is the general public's opinion that seems to count, doesn't it? If the whole general public is totally ignorant, then absolutely it's going to be quite easy to cover something up or to commit an atrocity and have nobody even ask questions about it.
And that is why I think it's so crucial to expose these templates, because once you start seeing them, they won't get away with it anymore. So, like I
but
said...
But the proviso, of course, meaning is that the entirety of the public would need to know these templates. And because people like you and I are not in control of the entire mainstream media apparatus by which to disseminate this information on a mass scale, it makes it very, very difficult indeed. It's almost like a war of attrition, okay? Very, very slowly hammering and hammering and hammering away, much like the Berlin Wall was, and then all of a sudden, after so many people are chipping away at the wall, so many guards are refusing to shoot the people who are doing so, it all just comes crumbling down. The problem is, people in our movement are hoping for that crumbling down phase, and they get really disappointed when it doesn't happen quick enough for them, because they're just not patient, like the New World Order is.
I tell you, when it comes to movements, there's once again YouTube. If you go to, I think it's, if you write in something like how a movement is created, there's a really, really interesting example. It's like at a rock concert, I think. There's some people sitting at a grassy knoll, like a slope, and they're just sitting there listening to music. Nobody is doing anything. And then there's one guy stands up, takes off his shirt, and he starts dancing like crazy. He's just really happy, you know. He's just standing, and everybody's sort of pointing fingers, laughing at him. Then, after a minute or so, or two, a second person stands up and starts dancing next to him, and the first guy welcomes him and says, yeah, yeah. So both of them are standing, making absolute asses on themselves, but looking really happy and dancing like this. Then a third person stands up and starts dancing, and then a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, a seventh, and suddenly, within a few minutes, the whole, suddenly, from all of these people sitting around looking at one crazy guy, suddenly they're the ones being on the outside if they don't join. And so the whole place starts dancing within a few minutes, But it takes the first crazy guy, and they say that it's not the first or the second. They are not the most important one. It's the third one, because then suddenly, you know, that opens up for a movement. And I think this is what is happening. We have been the crazy ones standing, dancing crazy and being looked upon as being crazy for a long time. Now more and more joins, but the tipping point goes very fast once it's once people start waking up. And I think that's where we are now.
Well, I've actually have a personal story of that nature to tell you then. There's a place in Auckland called Globe Bar. It's commonly referred to as a meat market. You know, that's where you go to get the butchers and what have you. You know, it's a place to go and find somebody to get laid with. And I went in there, and dance floor was dead. Okay, there were people on the dance floor, but they weren't dancing. Okay, and you see this DJ in the corner, and he's just sitting there. He's not even DJing. He's just sitting there, like, looking through his stacks of CDs and stuff like that, going, mm-hmm. And there's a big circle of girls on the dance floor, and then there's this big group of guys that are not on the dance floor that are just kind of standing and milling around the bar. And I was like, well, to hell with this. So I went up on the very top stage of the dance floor, and I just start busting some hardcore, like, nobody can frickin' touch me moves, you know, like really, really going for it. And within 2 minutes, the whole dance floor, all the guys came in from the bars, all the girls started boogieing, everybody started going hardcore. And I was like, my work here is almost done. I go up to the DJ. He still hasn't even noticed anything's changed. He's still flipping through his CDs. And I tap him on the shoulder. And I go, do you like what I did with your dance floor, bro? And he looks up and he goes, whoa! So, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. Because I am that one crazy person who got the whole crowd going.
Exactly. And this is how a natural movement is started. And this is why this is such an amazing time to live, because the dance floor is starting to rock now. You know, people are really starting to do all of these hardcore moves. So, no, that was a perfect example. If you want to go back to the template.
Yes, I'm sorry. Frickin', it's annoying being a conspiracy theorist sometimes, because you always go off on tangents and stuff. I'm sorry, I was interrupting. Go right ahead.
Don't worry about it. No, anyway, so if I'm in New Zealand, for instance, I could be any country, but I want the police to have, I want them to be able to drive tanks in the street. I want them to walk around with big bazookas, have drones to kill anyone they want, to kick in doors, to be able to arrest people without having the possibility with a lawyer or whatever it is. If I just did that, I would have a massive problem once again with the population. They would say, my God, what are you doing? What are all these tanks doing here? They would right away, I would have the problems once again, underground movements, riots, I would have demonstrations, I would have all of this problem. So that's not the way to do it. But that is the solution I want. This is what I want. Okay. So what I do instead is I secretly place a bomb. Bombs are the trend at the moment. Oh, mass shootings, these are the two things. I secretly place a bomb, and it's very, to create a problem, step one. And it's very important where I place this bomb. This bomb needs to be placed in a public place. It doesn't work in an old people's home or like handicapped people or anything like that. No, it needs to go emotional. I need to place in a very public place so that as many people will feel affected by it as possible. Oh my God, it could have been me, or it could have been my sister-in-law or whatever. So it's often in a train station, a storehouse, a public place. And very also one of the key things that I need to involve in this is women and children, to get the emotional reaction from the population. So there would be a daycare center or a children's hospital or something like that, very close, that would be affected by the blast. So I placed the bomb there. And once again, I do the same thing. This is where they use the drill. If you look at more or less all of these major attacks that have been done the last 20 years, there's been a drill going on at the same time. And this drill is doing exactly the same as what is happening. So it's a drill, but halfway through it suddenly goes live. So people who are involved, some of them have absolutely no idea like at the 7/7 bombings in London, like the police that were part of the drill, when people came out being totally blown up, they came stumbling out from the subway stations and there's smoke everywhere and blood everywhere. The police was just standing like, oh my God, it looks so real. You can't imagine the skill they had, these makeup artists and so nobody helped them because they thought it was a drill, but people were actually being blown up. And it's the same here. There's always, almost always a drill going on at the same time. Anyway, so I place the bomb and at the same time, I do exactly the same as with the assassination template. I create a patsy. This could be a group of people, somebody I want to get rid of anyway. So I prepare evidence for that. I also prepare my own investigation that will kick out all normal, honest detectives and police officers and so on, so that I have total control over the investigation that will just point at the patsy, point at the patsy, point at patsy, and stop any type of intrusion towards the real truth. Okay, so at the same time, also what I do when we get close to the bomb explosion itself, I block communication. Suddenly people's mobiles won't work, or radio broadcast, these type of things. You will see that 9/11, JFK, the whole telephone system went out for a whole hour nationwide. After 9/11, the whole area around the skyscrapers in New York were blocked. You couldn't use the mobile phones, anything. And they said that was because there was some antennas on top of one of the skyscrapers. Absolutely not true. It's blocked. You will see that as a general thing in these things. Okay, so I placed the bomb. I prepared the patsy. I prepared the evidence. I got my own my own investigation on standby. Very often I also have airborne troops that are circling the area, so that once this bomb goes off, if I have a problem somewhere, I can just redirect these troops and take care of it. So everything is set, and then it's time for the bomb to go off. It's also important when it goes off, it doesn't work in the middle of the night or late evening or something like that. No, it needs to be when people are the most emotionally vulnerable. So it would be in the morning when people have just started to, they've just woken up, they've just had a coffee, they're on their way to school with the kids or whatever. Then that's the time to hit them. So I'm waiting maybe 8:45, something like that. Everybody is on their way and boom, off goes the bomb. And what I do is through media that I have put on standby, or that I've been, I mean, they're very active anyway nowadays. So through media, I get all these horrific images pumped out with blown up children, blown up women, all of this, all of it done to get the reaction. Step two, this was the problem. Here comes the reaction from the population saying, oh my God, something needs to be done, something needs to be done. And they turn towards me, who secretly created the problem, but who they've elected to deal with these things. The population turns towards me and say, my God, you need to do something, you need to do something, this has to stop. And I say, well, to be able to deal with these violent truth seekers or yogis or whatever, or vegetable, whatever, the only way I can deal with them is, here comes the solution, by having tanks in the streets, police walking around with bazookas, being able to kick in doors, mass arrest, whatever. And the population will say, yeah, please do it, do it, do it. Not understanding that they're saying, handcuff me even more. You know, control me even more. And then I will be saluted as a hero. You will have all these national anthems in the background and banners like do 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 do. And then I come in on the white horse as the hero. And what I do is I kick out the shit out of this group, mass arrest them, eliminate them, shoot them, whatever. And then what I then do is I leave the tanks and all of this. I mean, nowadays the police almost look like robber cops. I leave them there for a couple of weeks for your protection. I will leave them there so that the population get more and more used to the sight of all of this military force. Often I also call for martial law with absolutely no reason at all, but just so that the population will get more used to it. And then after 2-3 weeks, I withdraw, but I don't withdraw all of it. I leave about 20% of these people in bulletproof vests with just a small tank in the street corner or whatever, and a lot of more cameras, surveillance things, all of that for the protection of the population. Absolute not true. What the population need protection from is me, the one who created it to start with. And this, once again, is the template for problem, reaction, solution. You will see this going on a very, very regular basis. At the moment, in the States, it's about mass shootings. And the reason why they do these mass shootings is they want the problem to be the guns, not the people using it. They want the population to say, oh my God, the problem is the guns. So you need to give up the guns. That is what they want.
Yeah, yeah.
Dearm the population.
Well, I mean, look back in history. Name me one instance in history where the authorities disarmed the general population, where they didn't subsequently enslave or exterminate that population who gave up their weapons.
You got Hitler, you got Stalin, you got Mao, these type of people, and now you got Obama. It's the same. I think it's very important when you look at Obama, you will see, in my opinion, the last real elected president, and there was even some fraud involved there, was JFK. The whole long row of presidents that have been in power since then has just been a mask, a different face in front of this brutal, brutal military-industrial complex war machine that has just been mowing forward. And the latest one is Obama, who's not even a real person. He's a constructed identity. It's an absolute joke when you look into it. Everything about this guy is fake. He's like a Trojan horse that has been moved in on stage.
Yeah. So, well, he's come in to shaft us, so he's more of a Trojan condom than a Trojan horse. It actually occurs to me that, you know, it's pretty obvious, really, that JFK would be the last president to be elected on his own terms and actually try and do some good for the people, and everybody else will be in control, because he caused a rift, I think, among the American populace to head away from warmongering. And I think that the military-industrial complex leaders saw the possibility of anybody ever rising up to lead the people towards a peaceful future as a threat. And they decided that they could not ever allow that threat to ever exist against them. They have a threat assessment, and so they're like, it's not worth the risk just letting anybody be elected. Let's make sure that we control all the elections from now on, and subsequently the presidents that are the result of those elections. Ole is my guest, and we will be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, ladies and gentlemen. And I have to encourage everybody, please, to donate to the show, particularly the New Zealand listeners, actually. I've just had a look at my Google Analytics, and there's like close to 1,000 hits from New Zealand just in the last month alone. If each of you 1,000 people decided to rig up an automatic payment into the Kiwi Bank of $1 a month, that's $1,000 a month. That can actually really help me to keep all this rent paid and keep the lights burning and the internet paid for and all of that kind of stuff, so I can keep continuing to expose scumbaggery. And if it ain't me doing all the radio and the video and everything like that exposing scumbaggery in this country, point to somebody who's doing a better job. There ain't one. I'm sorry, I'm not being arrogant here. It's just the facts of the issue. So if you want me to keep being around to expose scumbaggery, and if you want me to help train other people so that they can do it in my stead, and hopefully I can retire at some point, I don't know, go make movies or shoot a swimsuit calendar or something, I don't know. But at the end of the day, please, I need your support this week in particular, because we've got like a $900 shortfall this week that needs to be made up within the next day or two. So I really need your support, ladies and gentlemen, right now. I'm not joking about this. We'll see you after the break. Here you're fond of sand dunes and salty air. And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number 3 of the most thrilling 3 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Ole. And I think that's you know, have you ever thought about becoming some kind of like a conspiracy bullfighter or something like that? You know, like dress up David Rockefeller or something like that with little devil's horns and like get him to charge at you blindly, you know, like, I don't know, hold a child's skin or something like that to really, really antagonize him. Like, wait, that was really dark. I'm sorry.
That's really gross.
It'd be really nice, though, if he's like charging at you and then you get to stab him with a little knife, you know. All right. Just, you know, I don't know. Bullfighting, conspiracy fighting. Ole! I just had to make a lame joke. I couldn't resist. Okay, well, anyway, we've gone through the methodologies of how assassinations are pulled off and gotten away with and how terrorism is pulled off and gotten away with. And we've gone through what happens to a person who discovers this kind of phenomenon and the emotional trauma, sociological differences and things of that nature that really happen to you. Now, I want to quickly give a plug to your website. It's lightonconspiracies.com or lightonconspiracy.com?
Lightonconspiracies.com, because okay. There's quite a few of them.
How long have you been running that website for?
That's about a year and a half.
Okay. And you've been studying conspiracies for, what did you say, like 3 decades plus?
Yeah.
Okay. And JFK was your first one you've gotten onto. What about other ones? Like, in my opinion, it's kind of like a spider web nexus. So, like, almost every conspiracy kind of, in some way, shape, or form, you know, loosely ties into all the others because it's a similar group of conspirators that post them all off. I wonder what your view on, say, for example, chemtrails is.
I would say at the moment we're being attacked from so many different directions, but from the same group. If you track them back, if you're going back, or higher and higher, higher up in the power pyramid, you end up with the same people all the time. So I would say all these so-called terror acts, chemtrails, GMOs, vaccines, you name it, same people.
Mm. Yeah, I'd tend to agree with you on that one there. And this is actually one of the things that I find very interesting about the conspiracy culture as it's starting to evolve, is that you have groups that want to deny certain conspiracies' existence, connections, and what have you, and only focus on certain ones. One of these groups is the, I call them the It's the Jews group, you know? No matter what conspiracy it is, it doesn't matter if a water pipe breaks in Damascus or a princess dies in a tunnel. It's the Jews. And it seems to me that people want to oversimplify things. They don't want to actually admit that they don't know everything and kind of go into the complicated situations, connections, and what have you, and just for the sake of accuracy. And in so doing, they oversimplify and they say, oh, there's only one solution. And many people in the free man on the land sovereignty movement are also touting this line, this OPPT and so on and so forth, who say there's only one solution and it's this, there's only one solution and it's that. In fact, I had one of these people from Canada come into my home just the other day, and she's hoping to take the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, to court over the chemtrails issue. She's been trained as a legal secretary and all of these kind of things. She goes, oh, there's only one solution, I'm going to do this. And I said to her, how can there only be one solution? Let me ask you a question. How many ways is the New World Order currently attacking us? And she goes, well, every conceivable way possible. And I go, well, in that case, every single thing that you do against their agenda is part of the solution. Wouldn't you agree that there's not only one?
Are you asking me that?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you were asking her that. No, I totally agree. It's very, very easy to go into the oversimplifying thing. At the same time, I would say, in my humble opinion, everything that I've been looked into, not all of them, but a lot of them, goes back to the same group, and but it's also like with the chemtrails and so on, you have to come to a very, very high level to be able to pull this thing off. Why are these planes not shut down? You know, they go over, then they're not registered flights, they're not planes, normal planes, most of them.
They have their transponders turned off, yeah.
Transponders are turned off. Why are they not shut down? I mean, why are there not fighter planes up there forcing them down or shooting them down? The answer is they have got approval from a very high level. So why are they not being approached by the government? Why are they not doing something? Because for some reason, it's coming. The clearance is coming from a higher level, and this is the way you go up in the power pyramid to see that the only ones that can pull this off is on that top level, and that's where the different strings meet from whatever you look into, or many of these different things you look into. It's only by having the clearance from that level that you will be able to pull it off.
Now, the most horrifying conspiracy that I've found is the network of pedophiles that run around the world. This is probably the graduate course, ladies and gentlemen. If you go in, if you get to the point in your conspiracy study where you actually become aware of the global pedophile ring, that's probably about the most traumatic field of study you'll ever encounter. I haven't actually come across anything worse than the wholesale murder and rape of children. And because it's the most traumatic, this is my opinion, of course, it is also the least, palatable conspiracy for anybody to find out about. I was having a conversation with some of the protest march leaders, and over the break I was editing a bit of that protest footage. And some of these guys know about, local government corruption and things of that nature, media manipulation. They're starting to get into it. And then we started having a conversation over a beer about this global pedophile ring. And they were just kind of like, I don't want to believe that or anything like that. And one of the other guys at the table knew about this. It seemed that he knew just as much, if not more, than I did. And he kept trying to talk to these people about it, okay? And I could see them withdrawing, and I actually had to pull them aside and I say, dude, they're not ready for this, okay? If you keep talking about it, they're going to shut off and ostracize you as a result. Even though you've helped them in this protest, even though you've they trust you and everything like that, they're not ready for this one, not yet. You need some kind of slope to take you up there, sort of gently in a way, in order to make it even acceptable that there is a global pedophile network that uses child protective services, or in the New Zealand equivalent, child, youth, and family services. Basically, as I mentioned earlier, the lines of officialdom, whatever they say they're doing, it's probably the opposite. Well, if a government organization is there and it says it's there to protect the children, it's there to kidnap them and supply them to pedophiles, to a degree.
I can only say this is an area I try to avoid speaking about, just because, just like you say, because most people just shut down. Because what you describe is absolutely horrendous and absolutely awful, awful. Mm-hmm. What I found, however, is that when you start really going into great details and discovering what these groups are about, these pedophile rings pop up again and again, and the connections, and also the how they are not being looked into, but instead have got like a cover from the top. They're sort of like untouchables. Once again, we go back to the same thing. Who can support that? You know, who are the ones that will give them the possibility to pull this off without being exposed? And we come back to the same power elite again. I also feel that when you look into many of these conspiracies and the people behind them, It's like they worship the male energy, the brutal, muscular, destructive male energy, and they're totally against the female energy. And quite a lot of these people seem to be involved in sexual acts that is not considered normal, like with children, also a lot of homosexuality. I'm not saying anything about the gay movement. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about being against the female energy that I don't understand this type of mentality at all, but that is what pops up again from everything, from down on the street level when it comes to these mercenaries and serial killers and professional killers. There's a lot of gay activity going on. And also when you get up in the ranks, then it's when the pedophile thing gets more and more involved. So I don't understand it, but yes, it pops up again and again, and it seems very connected together, I would say.
Now, in order to maintain connections of this magnitude, one word comes to mind: blackmail. Mm-hmm. Anybody wants to stand out, say, hey, well, I really don't agree with this. Well, bro, we do have video of you molesting several children and whatnot. Are you sure you want to go through with this so that we can release it to the public with our massive propaganda media machine? Okay, maybe I won't. Maybe.
This is, I think, very what you're saying, because Uber fine-tuned the system of how to collect a lot of evidence to shut people down. You know, if anyone started to point fingers or something, he would have material that would just incriminate them so much that they would just shut up or stop whatever they were doing. And I think when you look on different countries, there's a very similar activity going on where the so-called security forces or secret services and so on, they collect information, they arrange these different types of, a lot of these so-called inside parties, you know, where they're actually sex parties with prostitutes, children, homosexual activities and so on. But what these people are not aware of that are invited to this, they feel, wow, I'm just part of the elite. But what aware of is that it's being filmed and documented, and so that it will, at any time that they will say anything at all, it will be used against them, just like you say. And this also goes with the Freemasonry rituals that people are invited in. And they don't. They think it's just a nice brotherhood that, great, we will help each other with business and take care of each other and so on. But in these rituals that they go through, they're not aware of that these are recorded and being used or possible blackmail tools against themselves.
Even the Queen, I think, retains certain powers. Like, for example, over the New Zealand government, she retains power over state intelligence services here, SIS. And I believe one of their charges is to investigate and gather dossiers on all politicians. So if any of those politicians start passing legislation that goes against the Queen's agenda of basically owning the country as a corporation and so on and so forth, you know, take your pick. Yeah, they can basically just destroy your reputation and you'll never work in the business again. And that's actually quite a credible threat, because if you spent your entire life trying to remain squeaky clean and there's only one tiny little thing and that the intelligence service has got and you don't know that they got it, all they got to do is just say, hey, we actually do have this. Shut up, boy. Shut up. And you do, don't you? Unless, of course, you want your family to be dragged through the mud. That's another part of it as well, threatening people's families. And you mentioned the Romans. The Romans had a saying, I think it was like, if you want to control the men, control the women. And if you want to control the women, threaten the children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say once again, you're very spot on. And there's a lot of like standard procedure, you know, how to control people. And also when you get up in the ranks within politics and other of these major corporations and so on, the only way to go get up there is through showing your loyalty to the cause. And in this case, the cause is sort of like the dark force. So you have to go through this, show your loyalty, and then that's the way to get get up there. But the more, the higher up you get, the deeper the shark waters you get into as well. So I for one, do not envy these people that are in there, because they're sort of like in a loop that they cannot get out of without destroying themselves.
It reminds me of the story of Donnie Brasco.
Yeah.
So deep in with the mob that you don't even know who you are anymore.
Standard procedure again. You lose yourself. They really symbolically sell their souls to the devil, as they say. And once you're in there, how can you get out?
Now, this also occurs to me as something Ian Wishart is exposing in his new book, Totalitaria, about the satanic agenda. Now, there is, the UN's supposed to be a secular organization, right? Allegedly. However, they do have a room in the United Nations building called the Meditation Room. And in that room, there's like a pyramid or something of that nature, or some satanic sigil for which the measurements or something of that nature add up to 666 or something of this nature. Many people have talked about the satanic agenda. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but I certainly have. The discriminated groups of people have changed over time. It used to be discriminated against blacks, discriminated against gays, discriminated against communists. Now it's discriminated against conspiracy theorists, discriminated against smokers, and discriminate against Christians. Have you noticed this too?
Yeah, it's different trends. Exactly.
I mean, if you're a smoker, a conspiracy theorist, or a Christian, you're just basically like a leper, you know? You just get cast out, you know?
Sounds a bit like you here, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You take at least some of the boxes.
Yeah. And it's actually part of the reason why I'm actually quite proud of to be one of the most discriminated against groups of people on the earth, you know? It's like, justification for what I do.
But when it comes to these satanic things, once again, this is an area that I leave to other people. I try to stay away from that because also, like you say, people shut down when you start talking about these things. And so I prefer to deliver the information that I have uncovered, which is more like on a street level, how things were carried out and who did it and so on. But one of the things that keeps repeating itself is the dates. They're very much into
numerology.
The rituals, the symbolism. You know, very often when they've done a hit, an assassination or something like that, within a year there's an obelisk erected there, like within 50 meters or 100 meters somewhere there for the decoration of the park or whatever. But it's almost like a business card or a secret language they have for their own members, just saying, here's another one we pulled off, and like giving the rest of us the finger almost. And also sometimes the place where the hit is done, the person is killed, is very often on some kind of ritualistic spot. You know, you got like, if you look from Google Map, you will see that the streets go into a perfect pyramid and the killing is done right at the top of the pyramid. Or you can have the park next to where he was hit, the decoration. If you look from above, you will see that the fountain is shaped like an all-seeing eye, and the lawns are done like in a triangular perfect pyramid shape once again. Or you got the eternal flame, like where they killed Diana, or like this symbolism is there. It keeps repeating itself, so they put a lot of effort into it. I'm not one that understands why they do this, and why also sometimes the place that somebody is killed on used to be like the place they chopped the head of people, you know, in the old days, or something like that. It's, once again, I don't know reality or what they're up to. I can just say that it's a very clear pattern.
Well, I came up with a phrase. It's called dark occulted mysticism.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like I say, I'm not an expert, so I don't go into these
areas. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, you know, if you can't comment because you don't know, just don't comment. You know, that's basically how it goes. I heard a rumor that the spires, the obelisks, are a way of kind of like channeling Luciferian energy from the sky down into the earth, kind of thing. Now, I'm not sure exactly how well that plays out. However, I do know that almost every single city and town in New Zealand, just New Zealand alone, has some kind of Masonic spire in the middle of it. Even Auckland City has a giant tower called the Sky Tower, which is the tallest building in the Southern Hemisphere, and it looks like an enormous syringe. Or something phallic. And that's basically another thing, is the phallic symbolism everywhere. And we've got this park. I remember having a conversation with some people who were like, yeah, you know, the kind of people we were talking about, the ones that shut down sort of thing. I was talking about the number 33 and how there's 33 bones in the spine, including the cranium, you know, the 33rd, the skull, you know, symbolizing enlightenment. And I tried to give examples of other things that come with the 33, but I couldn't come up with any at the time. And then the person next to me said, well, actually, there's a park in Auckland called One Tree Hill that is owned by Freemasons New Zealand, and it's exactly 33 hectares. And there's a spire on the very top of the hill that is exactly 33 metres above sea level. Love those numbers.
This keeps repeating, so I wouldn't underestimate the importance of it. I don't know why they do these things, but it's very, very repetitive. This the exact measurements, the exact you know, the numbers, the dates, like when they take someone out in a hotel room, very often the number of the room or the floor or whatever they place them. Very symbolically, or the number plates of the car that they use to hit and run, or whatever it is. I mean, there's one, I don't know if you heard about that, it was the so-called Queen's Day in Holland, 2009.
Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands Day?
Yeah. But even though she's, I mean, it was her father who was part of starting the Bilderberg Group, and she's very much involved in all of these things. But the if you look at exactly where was the hit was done, it was there was this the Queen's Day that was to celebrate the Queen, and they were coming the streets of Apeldoorn, I think it's called that, Appledorf or Apeldoorn, were filled with crowds of people, you know, cheering and so on, and the Queen and her family was in a like a double-decker bus, open one, and it was driving towards actually the Bilderberg Hotel. And right in the middle of this thing, when the bus turns a corner, there's a car that just plows through the crowd, a black car, and it just misses the bus, but instead goes in and crashes right in through a monument. This monument is a massive big obelisk. And when you see the whole filming, how they filmed it, the event, it starts with a TV camera while the bus is approaching. It films up and down this big obelisk. Now, really, when you look at it, it's so, so symbolic. Up and down, and then here comes the bus with the Queen, and suddenly, out of nowhere, comes this car and crashes right into the obelisk, killing apparently four people. These people, as far as I know, have never been identified. It's like it seems like it's one big false flag operation again, because there's once you start getting into and really look into the details, so many things doesn't make sense at all. It sounds like a super false flag again. But if you look at the point where this whole thing happened, if you look through Google Map, there's a perfect pyramid, and it's at the exact top where the obelisk is situated and where the hit is done.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll just take a moment for you there. I also wanted to put in something. It's kind of like an inside joke, you know, like if you know the punchline and what have you. You find it funny, but nobody else is even aware that there's a joke at all. And I liken this to truth or drinking games. I've created one truth or drinking game. It's the David Icke drinking game. If you watch a David Icke conference or something of that nature, every time he says the word decode, reality, or you take a drink, you know, and you'll find out that you get really, really drunk, and you actually have quite a laugh at how many times he says these words. Or if you can play the Alex Jones drinking game, every time he says it's admitted, every time he says I have the documents, then you take a drink, you know. It's just like an inside joke, whereas somebody who's not familiar with Icke or Jones wouldn't know why you were drinking and wouldn't know why you were laughing. And I think that's half of the methodology by which the New World Order operate, is that they have these little inside jokes that they love and they find funny. And there's another thing: they find human suffering amusing, entertaining, and they love it. They feed off of it.
Once again, I don't understand what they're up to. I don't understand the mentality, but it is just like you say, it is like they're thriving on these low energies, like fear and despair and depression and all of the low emotions. That is what they really feed off. That is my impression.
Well, I can actually elucidate a little bit here for you then. If you ever have a conversation with Thomas Sheridan or Jay Widener, and other people who have immense study on the mentality and motivations of psychopaths, what they've determined is that psychopathy is actually a mind parasite that feeds off psionic energy to a degree. I mean, for lack of a better word. And it is indeed a form of food for them. And without these low-frequency energies, the organism starves to death. If you were to put one of these psychopathic individuals on an island with nobody to victimize, no pain, no fear, no rage, nothing like that around them, apparently they die. It doesn't matter how much food or water they've got. This is what these researchers have been telling me. So there's an element for you, which I found very intensely interesting. Oh, and also, here's another thing. They're infectious. If you actually hang around these people for too long, you can become one of them.
What can I say? I can only observe and say that if you come from that angle, things starts making sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, alternatively, of course, we're thinking about the mentality, the lusts, and the desires of the elite. Everybody talks about the end game. What are they really moving towards? And I think, basically a lot of people have slammed this down and just said, well, basically they want to exterminate the majority of the population and have the rest live as not free-ish slaves like we are now, but total slaves, where everything is absolutely controlled. And this goes in again to explain the mentality of the elite, is that they're total control freaks. They can't handle people having freedom.
Oh, but if you look at the New World Order's agenda, what has leaked out in many different ways and areas, it's like, I would say it's the Fourth Reich. It's exactly what they tried to accomplish through Hitler. They didn't make it all the way there, but now they're doing it in a high-tech version. I mean, we're talking about the same power elite behind, the same financing, the same whole thing that was behind Hitler and both world wars and so on. Now they're trying again. They're really pushing forward. And what they try to accomplish is study history, and you will see it's Hitler's version. That you got like an Aryan race, an elite race, and the rest of us are super controlled slaves, just like you said. And there are too many of us, so they want to get rid of a lot of us. Mm. And the rest of they want to control through all aspects of life, microchipped, one world army, one digital currency that they control totally and just super control. But I would say I am totally not into the end game thing. I am super optimistic about the future because I think we are at a time at the brink, like I said before, that everything is now shaking and they're getting really desperate. I think the elite are really shitting their pants and seeing that things are falling apart because there's such an awakening going on. I think the future is going to be super. We just need to stay focused and stay strong and brave and just continue, laugh a lot and embrace each other, and we will sort this out in a beautiful way.
Three words, ladies and gentlemen. Stay the course. Mm-hmm. I had this philosophy a couple of years back, and I'm not too sure how much I believe in it now. I guess I still do to a degree, but it's that we've already won this fight, all right? We're just going through the motions here. The defeat of the New World Order agenda is at hand because it is being exposed, okay? That was the only thing that the human race needed to start off. It is like a snowball. We've already pushed the snowball down the hill, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and our victory is inevitable.
I totally agree. We're beyond the tipping point. You know, it's done. These are the last. It's like the dragon is doing what you call the last cramp movements from the tail. It's trying to do like this, but it's dying. It's dying, and they know it. I mean, I do not envy members of the global elite because I think they are very, very afraid at the moment because they think that if it's exposed what they've been up to for such a long time, we will chop them up and serve them as spaghetti bolognese, you know, and lynch them and so on. But if I have any say in this, this is absolutely not the way to go. If we do a revolution, listen to the word revolution. If you study every single revolution in history, it has come out like the people that accomplished the revolution becomes even worse than the dictator that they knocked off the throne. A year or two down the line, they're even worse. So this is not a matter of revolution. It's a matter of evolution. We need to raise above this whole thing and raise above anger, hate, and violence. That is not the way to go. If we go the violent way, they will have the force. They will be and use that as an excuse to hit back 50 times stronger at us and use it to control us even more. Way to go is evolution. Raise the energy so that we transcend this situation by truth, with truth, and with these high energies like love and compassion, forgiveness, and standing side by side. You know, just like Mahatma Gandhi said, just like Martin Luther King said, just like John Lennon, you know, give peace a chance, make babies, not war, that type of thing, you know, and take care of nature, start growing your own food, stop all this. There's so many different areas where we can control and start purifying life, start purifying and healing the planet and ourselves. And by doing that, we race to a level where they cannot reach us. So this is a super time to be alive.
What would you say to giving the elite amnesty? All right, the same way that the black South African movements gave the white South Africans amnesty. I heard this story that, and I think this is a similar case in Ireland as well with the British and the Irish, is that they said, look, you've treated us really badly for a really, really long time. And I know that you're probably afraid to give power back to the people who you've held power over for so long because you're afraid of reprisal. You might be afraid of vengeance that will pull you out of your plush mansions and hang you in the streets and so on and so forth. So what Nelson Mandela allegedly did, and correct me if I'm wrong, is he approached the power shifting on the basis of reconciliation rather than revenge. And I think that this would actually be a far better solution if you approach the elite and just say, look, guys, you do realize you've kind of lost this battle, all right? You had this desire, and it just hasn't worked, okay? You've gotten away with it for a while, but now we're kind of going to overthrow you one way or the other. So here's the option. You can either, A, keep doing what you're doing and wind up getting some kind of violent, uncontrolled, maniacal population who will kill and torture you to death in order to get the power back, or you can stop doing what you're doing, give the power back to the people, retreat to your mansions, and live a life of luxury, the kind you've enjoyed the whole time, except you won't have any reins of power. Your choice. What would you say to a proposal like that?
I would say there would be an option three as well, not to return to all these mansions, but to return to normal mankind, you know, to a normal life, a normal thing. If you look at the Truth and Reconciliation Committee and what they did in South Africa, because there you had a country where a small elite group had committed incredible atrocities against the population. And like Nelson said, that the only way forward is for healing to appear, to take place, is for transparency. All of these dark secrets needs to be exposed. So he offered these people amnesty if they came totally clean. A very tricky situation. But I believe in that way, because we can only go forward. All of these horrific things that has happened, it's in the past. We are now at a situation where we need to move forward into a new future, and the only way to do that is by forgiveness and compassion. I would believe, because it doesn't, if we just brutally kill them, it won't solve it really, because we will still have all of this inside of us and so on. I can only say that I have a beautiful, beautiful Raja Yoga teacher. Raja Yoga, that's the yoga for the minds, the science of the mind and how to quiet it down. And she has a beautiful prayer that she often ends with, and it goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who hurt us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light. Now, these words, I think, is a way forward, because it's only when these people that are so, how say I say, divulged, or I don't know this English word, but so in the dark, the only way for them to stop behaving the way they do is by filling this dark hole inside of them with love, or whatever it is that fills that hole. They cannot fill this hole up with greed or violence or all. They've tried that for centuries. It doesn't work.
The word you were looking for is devoid. Devoid of light, devoid of love. It means a lack of.
Yeah, this black hole I'm sure, I feel very strongly that this is what, this is why they're craving so much riches and so much. It's never enough. I mean, look at it. What are they up to? I mean, like, one family owns more than half of everything in the world. It's ridiculous. I mean, how big mansions, how many cars can you get? How many whatever can you get? It's like so out of proportions. And it's because this immense black hole inside of them needs to be filled. And the only way they can fill it is by spirituality, I would say, and spiritual love and power inside. That's the way to heal it.
Yeah.
So it's a very difficult question how to move forward, but I am for that, because I think the main thing is to stop this madness, to stop the chemtrails, to stop the GMOs, to stop the whole thing, and just let the world heal itself back into balance. Because the world is an amazing place where there's all these built-in systems, like the immune system, the global immune system. There's an immune system there as well. If you stop bullying around with it and stop pumping it with poison, it will heal itself very quickly. So we just stopped the madness. And then step two is how to do it, how to deal with these people that have been committed. Once again, I see them as teachers as well, because they are helping us to do this evolution. Without them, we wouldn't be in a situation that was forcing us to wake up like this.
Yeah.
But their actions is like, judge the sin, not the sinner. Their actions have been awful, awful, awful. So how to balance that and how to move forward? I would listen to people like Gandhi and Nelson Mandela, these people with great wisdom and knowledge, and how they dealt with it.
Yeah. Well, incidentally, Nelson Mandela was a member of the Knights of Malta, and Gandhi was quoted as saying blacks should be slaves. And what's interesting about this is that it doesn't mean that because one person is part of one bad organization that the entire person is bad and that everything they've ever done is bad. Does it? Okay? Again, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. How about this? How about the world is like a beach, and every grain of sand within that beach, save a few, is a lie. All we got to do is find those grains of truth, collect them, and use them.
Sounds good to me. But once again, these quotes, I would just say that you just quoted saying that Gandhi said that the blacks should be used as slaves. Was that what you said?
Yeah, or something to that effect. Yeah.
I would say I would be very careful with spreading these type of quotes, because who put them there in the first place? Yeah. If you see the actions of this individual called Mahatma Gandhi, that thing does not fit at all anywhere. So I would very much say it's very possible that things like that has been planted to
muddy the waters.
His exactly, because these agencies like the CIA and NSA and whatever in each and every country, I mean, they got massive budgets and they're not sitting picking their nose. They are attacking people that are standing up. They're discrediting people. They're taking care of people by violent means and so on. So just because you see that in a book or in a paper or something like that does not mean that it's true.
Yeah.
And just like with Nelson Mandela, I've heard a lot of things about him with question marks, saying who was he, or he was a member there, he was doing that. Okay, possible. I don't know. I have no idea. At the same time, look at the actions. What did this man do? What did he accomplish? And just don't just focus on one thing that you don't even know for sure is true. Mm. I have no idea about Nelson, but I know that what many of the things that he said and what he stood for, at least officially, was a beautiful way forward. So why not use that and maybe use that as a way forward for us as well?
Trees by their fruits.
Exactly.
You know, don't talk about what the person says or what somebody says about that person and what they said and whatever. Just have a look at the actions. What did they accomplish? What did they do? Did they accomplish copious quantities of scumbaggery and cover up a whole bunch of pedophile rings and wind up being implicated in a whole bunch of assassinations and cover-ups and so on and so forth? No? You don't have any evidence to prove that? Then they're probably not that bad, son.
And also, like, if you take me, for instance, I mean, I don't know what I appear to be like, but on my website, because I like the design and so on, I have half my face on it. That thing, and also that apparently I sit with my hand like this, with my cheek on my forehead, whatever. That apparently, according to some people, is a Freemasonry symbol. So because of that, they started this whole thing about me being a Freemason. Okay, fine.
With no evidence, you know.
But if that is what you want to think, okay, this could be spread that, okay, ole, 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 it's a Freemason, and he's doing a hidden agenda.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah. If that could be spread. I'm just saying, whatever the truth is, listen to whatever I say and see my actions, if they go hand in hand with Freemasonry or if they don't, and then make the judgment from that point. You know, so I can just say I'm not a Freemason, and I'm just because I have my hand like this or like this or like this, I don't know this symbolic language or whatever they mean. So let the actions and the word, and not just only the words, speak. Because if you let the words count, then somebody like Obama would be wonderful, absolutely wonderful. He says all the right things and all the, you know, to persuade us, great, but he doesn't do them at all.
Yeah. Oh, and, you know, this reminds me of, I had one of my listeners contact me on Skype. And do you know who Tila Tequila is?
The artist.
She is, but she's doing a bit of a... she was the first Asian Playboy cover girl, and she came out... And she came out a few years ago, and she started exposing the Illuminati that were working in Hollywood and so on and so forth. And these are things that heaps of people have talked about. It's not news, but because she's Tila Tequila, Playboy model and what have you, coming out and saying it, it can actually wake up a lot of people. Now, what this person... you'll love this, and it's so in line with what you just told me. This guy contacted me. And he said, because Tila Tequila's website, Miss Tila Tequila, because Miss started with the letter M, and that M was pink, it means that she's been assassinated by a drone strike and is now being impersonated by an actor, because there's a pink M on her website. And he said, if you don't believe it, then you're retarded. I think it's actually the opposite way around, bro. It's because you believe it without any evidence corroborating it whatsoever means you're freaking retarded.
No, but it speaks for itself. I mean, what kind of logic is that? You know, a pink M, I wouldn't even be able to guess it if I knew about these things.
Yeah.
But it's the thing with the internet is it's a wonderful tool for freedom and liberty, but at the same time it's so bombarded as well. I mean, these secret services and NSA and CIA and so, I mean, they're very aware of the power of the internet and trying to control it and also spread all this fake information as well. So it's very tricky sometimes to know what is true and what isn't, because very often they mix truth with lies. And just to make a total mess of the whole thing. So especially around these conspiracies, there's so much disinformation going around as well.
Yeah. And in fact, that's actually one of the other parts as well. I keep having to remind people of this. I mean, you come from the slave world. I call it, you know, where you believe everything that the government tells you, believe the mainstream media, you believe the cops are there to protect you and the judges are there to dispense justice. The child protection services are there to protect children and the food manufacturers like Monsanto are there to feed people healthy food. Okay. You figure out all that's a lie, and then you come into the truth movement, and you think that because you know all of that stuff is a lie, that you don't take all of those old habits of believing BS with you into the truth movement. You don't, okay? It's a long process. I mean, how long did it take you to get indoctrinated? High school, university, preschool, elementary, all of that kind of stuff all together? What did it take you? 20, 30 years of indoctrination? And you think because you've watched a couple of documentaries, suddenly you're not indoctrinated anymore and you're not under mind control? How do you know if you're under mind control? If you never question whether or not you're under mind control. I think that's about the size of it, isn't it?
Yeah, and also it's really important to find out about, just because it's a documentary doesn't mean that it's true, because these documentaries are also used very much to control the population. And you can often see when they're targeting a new country like North Korea or Iran or whatever, just before they want to do the attack, or Syria or whoever they're aiming for, there will be these documentaries that pops up once again with the problem reaction solution. Ooh, this country has such a bad leader, Gaddafi or someone like, he really needs, that is a major problem, to get the reaction from the population saying, well, it would be okay if you got rid of that guy, and in comes the solution, an invasion. These documentaries, they're some really good, and some of them are there to confuse us and to for their purposes.
Mm.
So once again, very important to keep an open mind when you see these things.
Yeah. I think one of the main problems that we have in this movement is psychological rigidity, all right, where you get psychologically invested in one particular worldview, okay? You abandon your old worldview, and then another one gets inserted for you. I think it's kind of like somebody who's a priest at the Church of Satan then renounces Satan and then becomes a hardcore psychotic Christian extremist, okay? All they're doing is providing you different catch nets on these different spectrums for you to jump onto. And the conspiracy movement's full of these kind of false dichotomies as well. You know, maybe this guy's an agent, or that guy's an agent, or something of that nature. Oh. And nobody seems to actually have much of a clue about who they are as people. And I think this is what allows them to be open for manipulation. If you're not familiar, if you're not confident and in and of yourself and your own spiritual awareness that you can't actually feel right from wrong, you're helpless. You're at you're at the whim of whoever is feeding you this BS information, aren't you?
Yeah, and this is why I put such an effort into trying to disclose who they are. And like I said, I've taken the part mostly on the street level to be able to identify the different assassins used in many of these different operations, to be able to link them so that people will start seeing that there's a very clear pattern and come that they're actually connected. Also, that, I mean, they're active to this very day. So if you want to, we could go back to, I can just start describing a little bit about this team of assassins and how they've been involved in different operations.
Okay, we've only got a few minutes left, so if you want to wrap us up and round it off with that, I'd be much obliged.
Okay, if it's only a few minutes, I'll just do it very quickly. Like, the group I'm talking about was called Operation 40. It was started in the early 1960s or late 1950s, and it was under the surveillance of President Dwight Eisenhower. He gave the CIA chief, Alan Dulles, the task to, together with Richard Nixon, Vice President Richard Nixon, to form a team of assassins that could be used globally to take out whoever they had problems with. And this group was put together with mostly exiled Cubans, but also CIA operatives. And in this group, since we only got a few minutes, I won't go into the names, but many of the people.
By the way, you can take as much time as you want, and I'll just upload an extended little broadcast. But I know that you're short on time as well, so don't hold back on anything that you actually feel is relevant and important. And I'll give you as much time and as space as you need.
Okay, thanks, Vince. Okay, this group was put together, like I said, under the supervision of Richard Nixon, Vice President Richard Nixon. And the man put in charge to do the funding or funnel the funds from the military-industrial complex, from the mob and from other groups was a man by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush. That's George Bush Sr. Now, George Bush Sr. was, his father was Prescott Bush, who was part of doing exactly the same, but doing the funding for Adolf Hitler, keeping the whole Nazi war machine going. Because this global elite wanted the Second World War to go, and keep going. Anyway, George Bush was involved with the funding of it, and his right hand that was given was a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez. Now, Felix Rodriguez was a high CIA operative as well, because they had tops from the CIA involved in this group, like Ted Shackley, the Blonde Ghost, David Attlee Phillips, and E. Howard Hunt, which was later one of the Watergate burglars. The whole Watergate burglary was done to cover up this group's involvement in this JFK assassination. So the people that was doing the burglary, all of them were part of the Operation 40. Now, when they started this, the main aim was to kill Fidel Castro. But then in the meantime, they did several attacks on Fidel Castro, but in the end, they failed. And in the meantime, JFK became a bigger threat. So what was done was that this cannon that they had created with, like there were between 40 and 86 members most of the time of these highly skilled assassins that was trained in guerrilla warfare and many other ways of assassinate people with bombs and poison and all of these things. While when they couldn't get to Fidel Castro, like I said, JFK became the current problem. So they just changed the cannon and aimed it at him instead. And in Dealey Plaza, the shooters that was there were sent. Most of them came from Operation 40, and then with a mob putting in their shooters as well. So, if I can go quickly through in Dealey Plaza, who were the shooters? In the Daltex building, the shooter was a man by the name of Chucky Nicoletti. He was the hitman from the Chicago mob, and he was supplied by Chicago mob leader Sam Giancana, who was actually staying at the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas that day as well. The shooter was Chucky Nicoletti, and the spotter. They always have two or three people in the team. There's one shooter, one spotter. The spotter is sort of checking out the area. He's also checking out the escape routes and so on. And sometimes there's a breakdown guy as well who takes over the gun, who takes the shells, get rid of all kind of evidence that is in the location and gets rid of it as soon as possible after the shooting. Anyway, in this case, the spotter, his name was Nestor Izquierdo. He was a member of Operation 40 as well. And in the same room, it was the office in the Daltex building where the shots came from, was a CIA front, a mining company. In that office that day was George Bush Sr., as well, the funding guy, and later the president of the United States, were in that. Together, there was one more man called Johnny Rosselli. He was the liaison between the government, the CIA, and the Chicago mob, or the different mobsters, because it was not only the Chicago mob, it was also the Miami mob, some parts from New York, and the Louisiana, where they got Carlos Marcelo. Santos Traficante in Miami, Carlos Marcelo, and Sam Giancana were one of the main ones in this hit. Okay. So that was the Daltex building. When you go up to the school book depository, the Texas school book depository, where Lee Harvey Oswald was claimed to have been shooting from, the so-called sniper's nest, the actual shooter in that sniper's nest, his name was Eladio Del Valle. He was a member of Operation 40, a former secret informer for the Batista regime on Cuba. And the spotter in that window was a man by the name of Herminio Diaz Garcia, a black mercenary who was also part of Operation 40. Then on the western, the sixth book floor in the Texas School Book Depository is one made big room. And in the opposite end of the room, at that window, there was another shooter. His name was Richard Kane. He was a former Dallas police officer who later became a lieutenant for Sam Giancana in Chicago, and he did the shooting from there. Anyway, you had, as far as I've been able to find out, Lee Harvey Oswald was absolutely not involved with this. He had been duped into thinking that his task was to infiltrate the group that was doing the assassination. And so he was actually there, I must say, as a hero, because he knew what he was up against. Not that he was going down as a patsy, but that he was actually risking his life to stop this whole thing. But I think his task was, he was on the second floor on the school book depository, and he was observed by one of the first police officers that ran into the building. He was observed very calmly standing drinking a Coca-Cola bottle. meaning that he could not have gone from the sixth floor down to the second floor in only 40 seconds without being totally out of breath. There were also people walking in the staircase, and nobody saw him there. So I believe that the reason why he was there was he was blocking the elevator so that the shooters on the sixth floor would not be disturbed during the whole hit. And he was standing right where this where you buy the Coca-Cola bottles, right. That was exactly where the elevator shaft came down. So his task was to stop them, to anyone to go up and use the elevator. And at the same time, the shooter later, just after the shootings, managed to get down inside the elevator shafts on ropes, since they were guerrilla trained fighters. That was the way they got out without anyone seeing them. Then when you go to towards the grassy knoll where the limo, the whole motor cage was slowed down by making, they made a change to the route going into a route that totally broke all security rules, because it was first a very sharp 90 degree turn into Houston Street and then a 120 degree turn onto Elm Street. And if you look at Dealey Plaza from above, for one thing, there's an obelisk. And for another thing is that it's an absolute pyramid shape where the hit was done almost at the top of the pyramid. Coincidence? I don't know. I'm just pointing it out. And also, so when we go further down the grassy knoll, there was in the grass, there's one guy standing with an umbrella, a black umbrella, and it's been speculated that inside this umbrella there was some poison darts or something like that. In my opinion, absolutely not. His task was to show the exact spots for the crossfire, because they had so many different shooters and everyone was supposed to shoot at the same time. Otherwise, it couldn't be blamed on one single patsy. If there were like 20 shots fired, you could never blame it on one guy. So he was the one. His task was to just show where the shot should be fired. His name was Roy Hargraves. He was very closely associated to Operation 40. And the person in front of him, there's a guy standing waving right when the limo passes, a dark Cuban man. As far as I and many other researchers have been able to identify, his name was Felipe Vidal Santiago, very closely connected to the Operation 40 as well. And this guy was later working under the name, the false identity of Charles Morgan. He was working for a CIA front company called ITT. And this was in 1963. But 1985, just a few months before the hit on the Swedish Prime Minister, he was in Stockholm trying to recruit assassins for that hit. And his job over the years had been to go to different countries and recruit assassins for different jobs. So here you can see there's one direct link between these two assassinations. Okay, on the street corner as well, on Dealey Plaza, when you go into towards Elm Street, one of the guys that you can see there, if you enlarge the photos, was a CIA operative, very high up, called David Morales. Now, this David Morales, he was part in this hit on JFK. He was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was killed, where he was there with two other very, very high CIA operatives, not doing the shootings, but being part of taking care of the whole operation. And he was also the one who later was sent to Bolivia together with Felix Rodriguez, the guy who helped George Bush with the funding of Operation 40. These two people were sent to Bolivia to try and track down Che Guevara, who was an accomplice or a partner of Che Guevara. And it was actually Felix Rodriguez who led a small patrol of military people. They tracked Che Guevara down, and the guy that was ordered to execute him was David Morales. Anyway, we go back to Dealey Plaza. And on the opposite side of the street, when you look at the Zapruder film, once the first shots are fired, look up in the right corner. There's very few few people that have noticed this guy. It's a guy in light clothes with a big dark brown bulletproof vest. Very obvious once you see him, but you're so focused on the limo that no one looks at him. And this guy is a man by the name of Walter Tobinski. He was the guy, one of the guys I mentioned before, who's one of the worst serial killers in modern time. And as far as I know, I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he and his partner, Clyde Forshaw, have been very, very active to this very day. Anyway, he's also the guy who's been, they took photos of being an imposter of Lee Harvey Oswald. But when he came out from the Cuban and Russian embassy in Mexico City earlier on, there are clear photos of him. But this guy, if you look at him at the Zapruder film, you will see that he, just when the limo passes, he takes like a tactical stance and he's got some kind of weapon firing something at the president. And according to himself, to one witness have told me, is that Walt Zabinski himself told that his task was to fire a tranquilizer, some kind of tranquilizer at the president to make him not be able to move so that the other people could finish the job with triangular fire. I don't know if that is true or not, but when you look at the Zapruder film, it makes a whole lot of sense because his technical stand, he fires and then he lets his hand drops down to the sides. And in photos taken just a few minutes after the whole motorcade has passed, you can see this Walter Tobinski walk very slowly, very relaxed towards the school Texas School Book Depository. Okay, so then we go down towards the grassy knoll. And if you there's like a wall, concrete white wall, and there's where the so-called Badgeman can be found. The Badgeman, or Black Dog, he's also called, is a man in a. It's been identified as a, he has a black Dallas police uniform on, and there's one photo where you can actually see where he fires right at the limo. Next to him, there's a railroad worker standing who took care of it. Once the shots were fired, he ran over to one of the bystanders who had been filming it, grabbed the film from this guy, then ran behind the picket fence, threw the rifle to the guy in the railroad clothes, who then he went behind sort of like an electric cupboard or whatever you want to call it, and bent down and took apart the guns very quickly, boom, boom, and put it into a toolbox and then started walking slowly towards the railroad tracks where he went into, I don't know where he disappeared there from there on. But anyway, that police officer, or fake police officer, the so-called Badgeman, as far as I've been able to identify, his name was Lucien Sarti. He was an international hitman, very, very bold, very careless, which made him feared by many, but also made him one of the best people because he didn't. He was so unafraid of dangers. He was supplied by through Santos Traficante from Miami. He was the guy who got the Marseille mob to import this guy. They flew them to he and two accomplices to Mexico City. They then went up to Brownsville in Texas, crossed the border there, were picked up by a member of the Chicago mob and driven to Dallas some weeks before. Anyway, we go there. Also next to them, to the right of these two people, that if you see that they reversed the car in, it's a white Oldsmobile, I think, and next to there's a shooter as well. You can see him in the Orville Max film very clearly if you know where to look for him. This guy, as far as I've been able to identify, is the person I spoke about before, Clyde Forshaw. Anyway, we go towards the picket fence, and on behind the picket fence is the guy that actually fired the final headshot. His name was James Files. He's still alive. He's in prison in Illinois. And he has come forward, not very easily. It's taken years for him to persuade him to come forward. But he did the final headshot. He was the driver for Chucky Nicoletti from, if you remember him, in the Deltex building. And he was only there to go there and supply the weapons and drive the escape car out of Dallas that day. But in just an hour or so before the assassination, there was the whole operation was supposed to be called off by some parts of the CIA. So Johnny Roselli, who was the liaison, he got cold feet and said, I'm not going to do the shooting. I back off. So then Chuck Nicoletti asked his driver, who had a very violent background, very skilled killer, if he would do him the honor of taking part of that. So he was fine with that and positioned himself behind the picket fence. There's a tree there. He was standing right to the right of it, if you look down from where the limo was. And the weapon he used was an XP-100 Remington Fireball. It was like a rifle pistol. It's a rifle, but made with a pistol grip and a short barrel. Very, very efficient weapon on a short distance, very accurate. And this was given to him by Ted Shackley from Operation 40 as well. Now, David Attlee Phillips from Operation 40. Now, this David Attlee Phillips is very, very interesting because he was the CIA handler of no one less than Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller and handler of James Files. And he was also the controller of a serial killer by the name of Michael Vernon Townley, who was later very integrated in a lot of different terror acts committed by Operation 40 and so on, and also was on location when the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was killed in February 1986. Yet another connection. It just goes on and on, but this is the general overview of what happened in Dealey Plaza this day. But it was so much bigger than that because the whole way of how there was absolutely no protection of the Prime Minister. The limo was positioned right up in the front instead of in the middle of the motor cage. His private physician was placed at the very back of the motor cage. The press car that was normally positioned in front of the presidential limo to take photos, that was placed behind it, way back behind it, and so on. And the whole protection thing with military protection and so, which normally takes place like a month ahead, you know, when Secret Service goes to a new town and just checks out all the dangers and takes care of all of that. Nothing of all that was done. It just goes on and on and on. So, I can only say that many of these members in Operation 40 was later totally central in the whole Operation Contras Iran scandal, together with Oliver North and so on. They were also very central in what was called Operation Condor, which was tracking down Allende supporters. They were part of doing the overtake of Salvador Allende, and also later tracking down his supporters globally and doing killings there. They were also part of blowing up Orlando Letier at Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., which was a major, major terror act on American soil. And the parts of Operation 40 was later, like the one guy called Porter Goss, he was later the chief of the CIA under George Bush Jr. And he was also involved, quite a few of them are involved in the 9/11 attack as well. And it just goes on and on. So this Operation 40 has been called the grandmother of all operations. And it's been so central, even though it's changed names many times. It's gone under many different names of Pegasus and G2 and I don't know all the different names. But in fact, it's the same group of assassins that have been used and are still being used. Now they're training new ones. There are new generations coming up and so on. But many of them are still alive. And that was about it.
All right. Well, Ollie, it's been a pleasure and an honour and various other nice adjectives, mate. I actually really appreciate all your research that you want to lay down here, and also your humility to admit that you don't know everything, which is actually quite rare for very credible researchers. And I want to thank you for that. Fantastic.
You're welcome. Can I also say I'm looking to make a documentary, a top quality documentary about Operation 40, because it connects so many of these major terror acts that have been committed the last 50, 60 years. Mm. And so I'm really looking to try and get in touch with John Pilger or people on his of his caliber, documentary maker. Mm. I'm also, if people would like to help me, just like you, with donations or signing up for my newsletter or so on, it's extremely appreciated. If you don't know what to do, how you can help, support people like Vinny and myself, because without, it's very, very hard to feed your family at the same time as doing this type of research. So any type of support like that is extremely appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're hungry for the truth, I can assure you, you'll wind up going hungry because you can't afford the food because nobody pays you very much for telling the truth. They do pay you a hell of a lot of money if you tell bullshit and kill people, on the other hand. I guess we're in the wrong business. All right. Thank you, Ollie. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for all your continued support and whatnot. And as I mentioned before, we've got like a $900 shortfall this week. So if you are capable of donating a significant chunk of change just to keep me on the air, you know, it's actually this close to the wire, ladies and gentlemen. I can't stress it enough. Wait, let's see. I think I just did with the tone of voice. Please help me. Please, you know, what do I have to do? Get down on my knees?
Well,
I'm already sitting down, bro. Okay, well, thank you very much, Ollie. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. And we'll see you again sometime, assuredly.
My absolute pleasure. You take care.
Cheers, mate.